Good Tuesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad you've joined us today. We've got a busy show for you. Dr. Timothy Wheeler with Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership going to join us a little bit later on in the hour. Talking about a piece at the Washington Post, do you own a gun? Why your kid's doctor needs to know. And the reason is basically so you can get a lecture. That's the short version here. And it's interesting. We'll talk about some specifics in the piece with Dr. Timothy Wheeler, but I have to say that the piece written by a pediatrician, she's describing visits to the doctors that I have not ever been a part of as a parent. I've never had these conversations with doctors. I've never been asked about whether or not I own a swimming pool, for example, or what type of household chemicals I might have under my sink. I've never been asked these questions. And yet the doctor here says, it's just like these conversations that we have with parents all of the time about all of these other subjects. Curious to see if as a parent, you've also been quizzed about all kinds of other things from your pediatrician, because it does kind of seem like the gun ownership thing is one of the biggies that that the doctors keep pushing to discuss. Jed Babin of the American Spectator joins us later on in the hour as well, talking about the narcissism summit, as he calls it. It says Iran and North Korea exposed its hollowness, the hollowness of this nuclear summit, weeks before our president convened it. But, you know, the pictures look great. And I wish there was more dancing involved, but the photo ops were amazing at this nuclear summit. Holy moly. And it's all about the optics. Jed has a new book coming out as well, The Encyclopedia of Militant Islam. We'll talk with Jed about that. Tom Mason of the World Forum on Shooting Activities, a story in Politico, the gun lobby stirs to life in Europe. Yes, even in Europe, gun owners are finding their voice. And it's kind of I won't say it's a new thing, because we've seen groups in various countries around Europe supportive of a gun ownership have a presence in the past, but they have not been, let's say, loosely organized together. They've not really had to band together. But I think even in Europe now, you are seeing pushback to the idea that, hey, the way we deal with these terrorists is by increasing the laws for the law-abiding gun owners. Those who already have to jump through a myriad of hoops and hurdles in many countries to be a legal gun owner, making life harder for them doesn't touch the would-be terrorist who is already, again, operating on the black market. Focus your attention there. Seems to be the argument. We'll talk about it again with Tom Mason. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum coming up next hour. You know, we recently took Julie and some of her colleagues with the Independent Women's Forum to the NRA range. That video, by the way, is up now at NRAnews.com. Make sure you check it out. Chip Everhart of Top Shot Academy, there in the Chicagoland area, is going to join us in Hour 3, talking about the violence in Chicago. Chip's also going to be part of the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day in Springfield, Illinois, coming up on Wednesday of this week. Katie Pavlich from Town Hall has a piece at The Hill. Obama proves, she says, that he is not serious about guns. I think he's serious about not liking them. But Katie's point is that the rhetoric and the executive actions, she says, don't add up. One of the first initiatives of 2016, she says, these executive actions, where he said every single year more than 30,000 Americans have their lives cut short by guns, 30,000. Suicides, domestic violence, gang shootouts. I believe in the Second Amendment, he said. It's written there on the paper. It guarantees a right to bear arms, no matter how many times people try to twist my words around. I taught constitutional law. I know a little about this, he says. I get it. But I also believe that we can find ways to reduce gun violence consistent with the Second Amendment. You will recall last week President Obama commuting the sentences of some 61 individuals, mostly drug offenders. Katie says these individuals were harmless, according to the White House, but a deeper dive shows serious and violent firearms-related crimes coupled with drug offenses, proving that, once again, Obama is not serious about reducing gun violence on the streets of America. Out of the 61 sentences commuted, 12 included the illegal use of a firearm during the commission of a drug trafficking crime. In addition, you had a lot of individuals who were charged with possession and use of a firearm as a felon who were part of the sentences that were commuted. You know, again, we've heard from President Obama for almost the entirety of his administration, but really starting in about 2012, about his desire to get gun control laws passed through Congress. If Congress wouldn't do it, he'd go ahead and take the boldest steps that he could via executive action. But one of the things that we haven't seen, I mean, while that has been said, you know, you can look at these commutations of sentences. You can look at things like Operation Fast and Furious. You can also look at the prosecution rates. They're within DOJ for federal weapons offenses, and those numbers have been going down. Now, look, you could say, well, crime overall has been going down. It makes sense that the numbers of these prosecutions will be going down, too. Well, crime is going down. But these cases, these federal cases, you know, the federal courts, the federal prosecutors decide which cases they're going to take. They could be taking more of these cases, getting more of the most violent offenders into federal court where the penalties are more severe and are also more likely to actually stick. Again, you're talking about a 10-year sentence. 85% of that sentence has to be served before you're eligible for early release. But we're not seeing the administration do that. And for much of the Obama administration, Chicago has actually been worst in the nation in terms of federal weapons prosecutions. And right now, Chicago is one of the worst cities in the nation when it comes to violent crime. So I think Katie is right. This is another bit of evidence that shows the president is not really serious about. Here's the thing, though. It's not that he's not serious about guns. That he's not really serious about reducing violent crime. I do think the president is serious about guns. I do think that the president would like to have more onerous or rigorous, I suppose, depending on your point of view, gun laws in this country. I do believe that the president would like to see fewer guns in this country. I do believe that the president would like to see fewer legal gun owners in this country, as well as fewer illegal gun owners in this country. I think the president is absolutely serious about that. But serious about dealing with violent crime? No, not so much, because I think he's more concerned and more serious about guns and gun ownership. You know, again, we're going to talk with Chip Eberhardt in Hour 3. Our Hero of the Day story today is actually from the Chicago area. And just a few years ago, you couldn't say that, because Chicago, in the state of Illinois, they didn't have a concealed carry law. Last in the nation to get one on the books. But at least, unlike some of the May-issue states, their law has some teeth. It's not perfect, but it is a shall-issue law. And now you do have concealed carry holders in the city of Chicago. You do have people who, again, can jump through all of the hoops and hurdles that the state has set before them in order to carry a firearm for self-defense legally on the streets of Chicago. You do have people who are doing that. And they are able to act in self-defense. They not just are able to, they are, as a matter of fact, acting in self-defense. Thankfully, they can do so because the city is becoming a much more unsafe place under the rule of Rahm Emanuel and the inattention of the Obama administration. So thankfully, you do have individuals who can protect themselves. The Chicago Tribune, with a story late yesterday, says the process for naming a new police superintendent has taken an unexpected turn in the past week in a rare but not unprecedented move. The mayor rejected all three names submitted by the police board and named Eddie Johnson the new interim superintendent, replacing John Escalante. By ordinance, the board must resume its search and submit three new names to the mayor. The mayor and the city council apparently have recognized that carrying out this charade would be meaningless and embarrassing. The council will likely pass an ordinance asking the mayor to select the superintendent with review by the alderman. So, again, you've got rules in place. You've got a superintendent, by the way, who's gone now, right? Gary McCarthy, out. You've got a city where the violent crime rate is spiking. You've got a department without a permanent leader right now. You've got a department where morale is pretty low right now. You've got a department that, again, a lot of the members of the community think that this department is full of racists, full of bad cops, who are willing to turn on members of the community. Rightly or wrongly, that's the impression that many in the community have of the police department. Rahm Emanuel said, man, none of these names, I don't want any of these names that you picked. I want to be able to pick the next superintendent. And even though under the rules of the city, under the bylaws here, the ordinances that we have in place, I can't do so if I just reject these names. Again, never letting a crisis go to waste. I can assume more power than I had before as mayor. And it looks like he's going to get it. Chicago Tribune says this awkward state of affairs reflects the importance of the police chief appointment. The mayor simply can't afford to make the wrong call. A process designed to take some of the politics out of the process has proved unworkable at a time when the mayor must find a new police boss who is respected by officers and can hit the ground running. That would have been virtually impossible for the two outsiders on the original list. So the mayor opted to take the heat and picked a veteran of the department who, by all reports, has the support of the rank and file. Do you think, by the way, and again, I don't pretend to be an expert on the inner machinations of Chicago politics or the selection of a new police superintendent, but do you really think that the members of the police board who picked these three names did not consider the effect that appointing an outsider would have on the department, for better or for worse? I'm not saying they gave it primary consideration. I'm not saying that they reached a completely different conclusion, the same clues that the reporter here at the Chicago Tribune has reached, but it strikes me as absurd to think that they would not have taken this into consideration. Perhaps the members of the police board felt like they needed to move in a new direction. Rahm Emanuel apparently decided differently, at least didn't like the direction that the police board wanted to move in. And so, again, with a department in turmoil, with a city in the middle of a crime spike, Rahm Emanuel has decided, you know what, I'd like to use this as an opportunity to gain more political power. And that's what he's doing. Again, much to the detriment of the good people in the bad neighborhoods in the city of Chicago. The Chicago Tribune says Eddie Johnson, the interim police superintendent, will be assuming command at a time when the department has suffered a number of hard hits and officer morale is poor as a result. Arrests and investigative stops are down dramatically, a strong indication that street cops are less aggressive in their work. Effective policing, the paper writes, requires officers to be prepared to step in to arrest criminals, but also to prevent potential crime. In doing so, they must have confidence that commanders have their back when they act within policy, even if the result is controversial. And there will be controversies, the paper writes. With thousands of officers on the streets every day interacting with citizens, including criminals, it is inevitable that some people will claim, rightly or wrongly, that they were abused by the police. The bosses have to be able to separate legitimate claims from bogus ones and defend officers who are doing their job. Nothing in there, by the way, about the media having a responsibility to the community that they serve. Again, fairly and impartially report on and investigate these stories, not trying to drum up controversy because, hey, it sells papers, it makes people watch the nightly news, it increases the page views and the click-throughs. Nothing in there about that. This is about the police. The Chicago Tribune says improving morale goes hand in hand with reducing violent crime. Crime in Chicago is down substantially from the 1990s, but has risen over the past year. It's actually more than just the past year, if you want to be honest. The statistics for the first quarter of this year are particularly troubling. Murders and shootings are up dramatically over 2014 and 2015. Equally disturbing is that the number of murders in Chicago is substantially higher than in New York and Los Angeles, which have larger populations. The first step in the process, the Tribune says, must be an honest assessment of the manpower needs of the department. For years, the mayor and the superintendent have said we have enough officers, while the Fraternal Order of Police and many individual cops argue that we need substantially more policemen. Budget issues have had an impact on all city departments, including the police. And it may be true, the paper says, that any reduction in personnel has been offset, at least in part, by better use of those who are on the job. But it is time for the leaders of the department to examine what has to be done to bring down the gangs and their guns and drugs and clearly convey that reality to local political leadership and the public. We'd probably want to get some prosecutors involved. You might even want to get some federal officers involved. You're probably not going to be able to bring down the gangs and the drugs through the use of the Chicago Police Department alone, because I got to tell you, I suspect in a city that has a history of corruption as deep and as broad as Chicago, you're probably going to find some commingling of crime and politics there at the local level. So get ready for some corruption probes as well, if you really want to bring down the major criminal enterprises there in Chicago. The paper says, something like this, I don't even know why they bother to write this. Whatever the optimum size of the department, it is a big operation, requires good leadership, not just at the top, but in the field as well. Wow. Thank you for that insight there. Big police department needs good leadership all over the place. Johnson probably knows the department's personnel as well as anyone, the paper says, but that's just the start. He must be able to identify good leaders, and being a good leader isn't always the same thing as being a good patrol officer or detective. Apparently Captain Obvious took over the writing of this story at some point. The reporter had to step out, and he just took over. An early order of business for the command team, the paper says, should be to evaluate the strategy developed under the previous superintendent of dismantling special units and assigning those officers to the districts. Some critics have argued that Chicago street gangs are at the heart of the city's crime problem and deserve the full-time attention of specialized units. Some have argued that, huh? I thought that was a fairly established fact, but we'll talk about it again with Chip Eberhardt. You know, again, researchers have shown that there's a community of about 6% of the population of the city of Chicago. And if you live within that 6%, you are much more likely to be the victim of a violent crime. You're also much more likely to be a perpetrator of a violent crime. The more people that you know within that network that comprises, again, about 6% of the population of the city of Chicago. And it is a network that is based primarily on gang affiliations. The more individuals you know within that network, the more, the closer you are to the heart of that network, the more likely it is that you are going to be the victim or the perpetrator of violent crime. That's just the way it is. Strategies, law enforcement strategies that don't take that into account, that don't view that that population as the biggest priority to try to prevent violent crime, to try to turn those individuals from the path that they are on, to try to protect those individuals who are most likely to be victims of violent crimes, I honestly, I don't know how on earth you can expect to stem the violence if you are unwilling or unable to recognize the problem. But we will see what happens in Chicago beyond the political power grab by Rahm Emanuel. Again, doing a lot of meetings behind closed doors. Not doing a lot of public appearances these days, but bitterly clinging to power. And as a matter of fact, trying to get even more right now. All right, we're going to step away for just a moment or two. When we return to the program, Dr. Timothy Wheeler with Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership responded to a piece of the Washington Post. Do you own a gun? Why your kid's doctor needs to know. Stick around. We're just getting started here on this Tuesday edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors, welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes. That's Tell great. Us, what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball. I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. When I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch-thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you when people do this. And out of necessity, what's born this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day right now, the numbers from the DOD. It's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
So Cosmo Magazine, at it again. This time they've got a little video feature on watch four boyfriends listen to their girlfriends tell them how they really feel about guns or something like that.
Right.
And oddly enough, Kimberly, not one of the women featured there is really okay with the idea of her boyfriend owning a gun.
Well, and really, where are the women like me in that video? All I saw were women who had an unhealthy fear of firearms, basically because the media has told them that they should. Ironically enough, it was actually an article in Cosmo that resonated in my 20-year-old mind during the early morning hours of my assault. So I had read some story about a woman who used the tact of befriending her rapist who had kidnapped her. She convinced him that she wasn't going to tell anyone, and she escaped. I tried the same thing after my assault was complete. He left my bedroom to go get a drink of water from my kitchen and then took off through the front door. I had no way of defending myself that morning, but, I have stared in the eyes of pure evil, and I knew that I wouldn't be left defenseless again. So, of course, I choose to learn about concealed carry and train to a point where I'm comfortable using a firearm for protection. I am literally nowhere represented in that video.
Nope. Not at all.
At all.
No. I mean, in fact, you got four variations of the same theme.
Right.
As you said, I am afraid of firearms. One guy even said, look, I keep my firearms locked up. And his girlfriend said, so you don't know how to operate a key when you're drunk? Which to me makes me think, okay, is the concern here his drinking or his gun ownership? There was a lot of stuff that you wish you almost wish you could have been a relationship counselor in that situation, right?
Exactly. Well, and I think by design, they cast males as the only gun owners in that video because honestly, they're easier to villainize because statistically speaking, men are usually the perpetrators of domestic violence or sexual assault, at least more often than women.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Coming up on the program this afternoon, we've got the latest legislative news for you. Also, the latest on Operation Choke Point. Jed Babin's going to join us a little bit later on in the hour. But right now, we want to welcome to the program from Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership, Dr. Timothy Wheeler joins us. Dr. Wheeler, how you doing, sir?
I'm great, Cam. Thanks.
You bet. I appreciate you coming on the program. So there's a piece of the Washington Post yesterday written by a doctor. Do you own a gun? Why your kid's doctor needs to know, arguing that, look, this is no different than asking or quizzing parents about pools or chemicals that they might have in the home, does your child wear a bicycle helmet? This is just a common sense a question that they can ask that they can then provide information on safe storage and things of that nature. That's the argument that's presented.
Yeah, well, Cam, I tell you, I was listening to the segment just before this about the videos of the young women in Cosmo and some of these other young ladies, media outlets, trying to convince their boyfriends to give up their guns. This piece in the Washington Post from these two pediatricians seems to be in the same vein. I really think that this is an attempt, once again, to portray this idea of pediatricians counseling you about guns as something legitimate, and gun ownership is, not quite respectable. I mean, really, if you want to know about gun ownership, are you going to seek the opinion of two pediatricians from one of the most anti-gun towns, Santa Monica, California, in the whole country, who don't know anything about guns? I don't think so.
You know, what's interesting, Dr. Wheeler, is I've seen other stories over the last year or so talking about this issue, and it probably doesn't come as a surprise to gun owners, but there are plenty of doctors beyond yourself. You are not the only doctor in America who owns a firearm. There are lots of doctors, nurses, medical professionals who are also gun owners, and also who are not really sold on the idea of asking these questions and then, being the one to lecture their patients about their gun ownership. They're not on board with this. They see this as sort of beyond what they want to do and what their job is as a doctor.
You know, there are several online sites for doctors, that talk about medical practice and, the issues of medical practice that doctors would be interested in. Every once in a while, they have polls about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think doctors should ask their patients about guns? And every single time they run one of those, they get a flood of comments overwhelmingly against it. Now, in this Washington Post article, it's interesting because these two authors are addressing an issue in the Wolfschlager case, the Dox versus Glock court case that's been brewing down in Florida for about 5 years now. They're talking about some issues that we are bringing up in the latest round of the court considerations in the appellate court down there. We have an article on our website, if I may just mention it.
Sure.
That was March 29th. Our listeners can go there. It's drgo.us and read that article, our blog entry, on March 29th, and it'll give them an update on what's going on with this. It's very interesting because the pediatricians now realize that the argument is going against them, and this article in the Washington Post is an attempt to counter that and to ridicule it, of course. These folks talk about how ridiculous it is to think that a doctor shouldn't be asking about guns in the home. So this is a cutting edge issue in the litigation of Dox versus Glocks, and that's what this article is all about.
Yeah, one of these arguments that they mention, they talk about the court. The court panel wrote, when a patient enters a physician's examination room, the patient is in a position of relative powerlessness. The patient must place his or her trust in the physician's guidance and submit to the physician's authority. To support this contention, they write, the court cited a 1994 law review article that describes how the patient-doctor relationship forces patients to, quote, suspend their critical faculties and limits their ability to, quote, question physicians and redirect the course of a conversation. They say most doctors nowadays would laugh at that idea. Ha, 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 ha. Here's the thing, though, Dr. Wheeler. I don't know how many patients would laugh at that idea. You know, you do when you're going into a doctor's office, particularly, I would say, a pediatrician's office. You know, you are there. I don't want to say that you're being judged as a parent, but But as a parent, there's a little bit of, I want my kid to be healthy. I want them to be on their best behavior. I want the doctor to know that I'm a good parent. And all of a sudden you get a question, are you a gun owner? Well, let's talk about your gun ownership, Cam. You know, you're not necessarily on equal footing and equal terms, or at least many parents, I would think, would not feel like they are on equal footing or equal terms with the doctor in that setting.
That's right. And these authors, these two pediatricians, ridicule it and try to turn it into some kind of, you know, 19th century authority issues problem. It's not that at all. I wish I had time to talk about it today, Cam, but let me tell you that the March 29th article on our website and one that's coming up on Thursday this week is going to discuss this in detail, including the amicus brief that was filed by Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership's parent organization, the Second Amendment Foundation. That was just filed last week, and our attorney author, Joseph Greenlee, has discussed it in great detail with great expertise. Check the website, drgo.us, March 29th and this Thursday for entries on that. And it'll tell them, everybody, what they need to know about this whole issue.
I absolutely will do that. And you know, Dr. Wheeler, while we've got you, I got to highlight one other part of this piece that really rang false to me as a parent. She said, as pediatricians, we counsel parents about all of these issues. We explain how to properly install car seats. We caution against children playing with plastic bags. We teach about safe water temperature. We discuss safety around pools. And gun safety is no different from any of these topics. I have to tell you, Dr. Wheeler, I have never had a conversation about any of those things with any of my pediatricians for my children.
Well, it is true, Cam, that they are supposed to discuss that. They don't always, you know, your typical doctor visit these days, you know, is so short, and believe me, doctors don't like that any more than you do, that a lot of times they don't have time to get around to all those. But really, those are issues that pediatricians have discussed with their patients for years. It was only in the 1990s that they added guns to the list and tried to make it legitimate by including it in that list of probably legitimate things to issue to discuss with parents. I mean, you know, you don't want your kids falling in the pool. You don't want them, you know, drinking household chemicals that are toxic. But gun safety is different from those topics. I find it interesting that just in that same paragraph, the authors quote every town for gun safety on some gun safety statistics. You know, that's one of the biggest gun control organizations in the country now, funded by Bloomberg, and they completely ignore the real huge educational gun safety organization, the National Rifle Association. If these pediatricians are serious about gun safety education, why do they consistently refuse to work with the NRA, which is, you know, has more experience and has done more for gun safety education than anybody in the world?
You know, it's a fantastic question, and I can only assume, Dr. Wheeler, that it's because the people who are pushing this idea are also the ones who are pushing us to view guns as a public health issue and gun ownership as a public health issue.
You're exactly right, Cam. Their goal is not teaching gun safety. Their goal is pushing gun control politics, and that's wrong.
Dr. Timothy Wheeler with Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's always a pleasure talking with you today.
Thanks for having me on again, Cam.
You bet. We'll do it again very soon. Dr. Timothy Wheeler with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Jed Babin of the American Spectator coming up in just a little bit. I swear I've never been asked pool safety questions. Now, it's true. I have not gone to every one of my kids' pediatrician's visits, so perhaps I've just missed out on those conversations. But the idea, again, that you as a parent, or even, heck, you as a doctor, are going to be in that position of delivering that lecture and perhaps even collecting that information about the gun ownership of their patients. And like Dr. Wheeler said, it's interesting to go online and read some of the discussions that medical professionals have regarding this issue. You get the impression when you read stories like this in the Washington Post or opinion pieces like this in the Washington Post that there is this vast consensus among medical professionals that that this is a good thing, this is the right step to take, when in actuality, there is no consensus. You have plenty of medical professionals who think that this is outside of the purview of medical professionals. All right, Tom Mason coming up next hour, talking about the gun lobby stirring to life in Europe, so reports Politico. But we'll talk about the narcissism summit, as Jed Babin has coined it, the big nuclear summit. He says Iran and North Korea exposing the hollowness of this summit, as well as perhaps the president's foreign policy on these issues. Also, we'll talk about Jed's brand new book. Stick around. We have much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and da-da-da, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years. And then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on, she's been through hell. I can say hell, can I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago. 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and Mark, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years older. This is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it, and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience that he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids, you know.
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by Nosler. We've got Chip Everhart of the Top Shot Academy in the Chicagoland area coming up in hour three. Katie Pavich of Town Hall as well right now. I want to welcome from the American Spectator, Jed Babin. Jed, how you doing, sir?
Well, not bad for a grumpy old guy. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. I appreciate you coming on the program, the Narcissism Summit. I love it.
Yeah. Well, it's a great title. I'm glad I came up with it. But, you know, if you look at the summit, they didn't do anything. Surprise. You know, Mr. Obama has another event, and he writes a self-celebrating op-ed in the Washington Post, and they get down to business, and, yeah, they don't do anything. So here we go again. But you look at some of the other things going on around it. This was supposed to deal with nuclear terrorism, with the problems of nuclear proliferation that really beset the world right now. And, yeah, it really didn't have much of any effect. But the people who are actually the subject of this sort of a limitation, the subject of this sort of discussion, they're out there doing a lot of bad stuff, like North Korea and Iran.
Well, absolutely they are. As a matter of fact, I mean, as you talk about Iran and North Korea exposing the hollowness of the summit weeks before the president even convened it, even while the summit is going on, it's hard to ignore, and yet some other president has managed to do it, it's hard to ignore the belligerence, I think, is a fair word to use here, Jed, when it comes to North Korea and Iran. It's not even a matter of testing the United States at this point, because I think that they have tested the United States. They know what this president will and will not do. And the president, has stated his point of view fairly clearly. He thinks that, responding to actions like this, that makes the country look weak. That makes him look weak. So it's better to just sort of try to stay above the fray, ignore all of these little provocations, and then eventually all will be sunshine and light.
Well, maybe not. I think you and I are probably in agreement on this. You have things like, and you talk about belligerence. The North Koreans have pretty much retired the trophy on belligerence. You know, before this summit came about, they were, number one, putting out a video that showed supposedly a nuclear attack on Manhattan. They were threatening a preemptive nuclear strike against the United States. And you've got the Iranians out there testing missiles. And they're supposed to be limited, of course, by U.N. Security Council regulations and resolutions. But they're not, as is no surprise to any of us who followed the U.N. for the past X number of years. So you've got all of these people out there who are not just belligerent. It's not just words. They're really making specific threats against us, and they're posing specific threats against us by testing nuclear missiles and so forth. There are really some bad things going on out in the world here, and the president just doesn't seem to be willing to deal with them.
No, the Supreme Leader of Iran, the day before the summit, as you quote, saying, "Those who say the future is in negotiations, not in missiles, are either ignorant or traitors." You hear language like this, and then you hear the president speak, Jed. There's news out of North Korea that the North Korean government has told its people to get ready for another famine, basically. Start collecting leaves to eat again. This is a sign that North Korea, again, is pumping even more of its economy into the military. These are genuine warning signs, as you say, and yet is there an unwillingness or just a complete lack of desire on the part of this president to deal with this? Is this just past the buck time now?
Well, yeah, I think it is. He's just kind of coasting out to, through his last year. I mean, obviously he wants to do more things to hurt our economy, which he's going to do, but that's another subject. And he really has shot his bolt in foreign policy. He hasn't made any successes at all, but right now he's just kind of coasting. And these things go on and on and on. You see, just for example, we were talking about that a moment ago, the missile tests that Iran is running, that North Korea is running. I mean, these guys do not have a peaceful nuclear weapons program. Not only, you know, is that an oxymoron, but they do have nuclear weapons in North Korea. They're developing them in Iran. And you've got to ask the real question, why are you developing ICBMs if you think that you're, if you want us to believe that your nuclear program is peaceful? There's no point in developing those missiles other than to mount nuclear weapons on them and have the capability of launching them. That's really just, it's amazing to me that people don't put two and two together at that point, because it's really inevitable. How can you miss that?
You say that the threats emanating from Iran and North Korea are real, but you also provide some steps as to how to deal with those threats. And you say that the first thing that we need to be doing, and this, again, doesn't apply just to the United States, but to the free world or what remains of it, is to do whatever is necessary to interfere in the cooperation between the two nations. How strong are the ties right now between North Korea and Iran? I know that there have been some reports of maybe some North Korean troops actually in Syria fighting on behalf of Assad, but how strong are the ties between North Korea and Iran right now, Jed?
Well, very, very strong, and we have to realize that people go back and forth between those two nations regularly, and the people who are doing that sort of travel, they're not just diplomats, they're not interested in opening business, because, you know, North Korea has no economy and Iran only has oil. But the basic point here is people are the element of nuclear proliferation. They're the element, the necessary element to the proliferation of missile technology. So what we've got going on right now here is cooperation between the two nations on both of those fronts. And what we ought to be doing, and I, you know, it's not privy to the secrets, so I may very well be wrong, but I don't believe we're doing a whole lot to interfere with the communications that those people have between the two nations. And, you know, the CIA and the NSA have some pretty nifty stuff. And if we wanted to, and I assume that we are doing it, but who knows, we could really interfere in that communication. We could invade their computers. We can do a whole lot of stuff. We don't have to shoot at anybody, but we can do a whole lot of stuff that really would retard the progress between the two nations. I don't know if we're doing it. I hope we are, but Lord only knows in this administration, probably not.
Is the, I mean, you look at these two nations, Jed, and there's not really a lot of commonality here other than hatred of the United States and the West. Is that the tie that binds those two countries right now?
Yeah, I don't think there is another one, really. I mean, you're right. There's nothing that ties them in terms of religion or economics or common goals. I mean, all they want to do, the only common goal they have, is to help each other with nuclear weapons, nuclear missiles, and, you know, basically to make a greater threat towards the West. You know, we are the ultimate enemy. Europe is certainly the enemy. Israel is the enemy. And they want to threaten us all mutually as to the greatest extent they can. So that's really what's going on.
All right. Well, we've got you. I got to ask you, I don't know if you've seen the piece at the Daily Beast, Shane Harris, Nancy Youssef, reporting that they found three individuals who say that people are being pushed out now for not giving the happy talk. Intelligence analysts are being pushed out for not providing the happy talk that President Obama wants to hear when it comes to ISIS. They report one of the analysts alleging reprisals is the top analyst in charge of Syria issues at CENTCOM. He and a colleague doubted rebels' capabilities and their commitment to U.S. objectives in the region. The analysts have been effectively sidelined from their positions and will no longer be working at CENTCOM, according to two individuals familiar with the dispute and who spoke on condition of anonymity.
Well, I've seen the report. I have no reason to doubt it. You know, the basic point here is we have had real significant reports for months now that CENTCOM had been, the senior people at CENTCOM, the commanders, had been basically modifying the intelligence findings before they went to President Obama to paint a rosy picture as to what was going on with ISIS. So this does not really surprise me. The only problem now is how do you fix it? And we don't have an administration that's willing to fix it. Whether you have senior military people who are willing to fix it, I don't know. But this is the kind of thing that Defense Secretary Carter should be paying personal attention to, and should be, he should be down there at CENTCOM right now straightening that out.
Jed, as always, sir, I appreciate you coming on the program. Before we let you go, we've got to talk about your brand-new book. Tell me about this, the Encyclopedia of Militant Islam.
Yeah, the Encyclopedia of Militant Islam. You know, I'm glad you asked about that, and thank you for doing so, because there really isn't another book like this anywhere in the world. All of this information, I'm sure, is contained in a bunch of CIA computers somewhere, and they probably have more than we do. But this is a research project that we went into. It contains descriptions of 44 separate Islamic terrorist groups, where they came from, who founded them, you know, what kinds of acts of violence they've been guilty of, who funds them, that sort of thing. And it's really a very useful reference book, I think, to anybody who wants to be informed on these subjects. And, you know, God knows everybody in the news business really ought to have a copy.
Absolutely. This is out now.
It is. You can find it on Amazon.com, the Encyclopedia of Militant Islam. It's authored by a guy by the name of Brian Griffin, with chapters written by me and Herb London, and it should be right on your desk, sir.
Fantastic. Well, listen, I'm looking forward to reading this. As you say, I would like to see more journalists, particularly those who are covering these issues, know a little bit about the groups that they're covering. That would be a good thing, Jed.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice to just have some idea of being informed of this stuff? Yeah, seriously, this is the kind of thing that a lot of people are going to be interested in, I think. And it's just it's a very useful book. Anytime one of these jokers attacks, you can really pick it up and find them right there, and it'll tell you an awful lot about them.
Awesome. Well, listen, thank you again for coming on the program. Best of luck with the book, and we'll be doing this again very soon.
Thanks very much.
All right, see you soon, Jed. Jed Babin joining us from the American Spectator. Again, the brand new book, The Encyclopedia of Militant Islam, is out now. Now, back to that Daily Beast article, Shane Harris, Nancy Youssef. So they found, again, three individuals, two senior intelligence analysts at CENTCOM say the military has forced them out of their jobs because of their skeptical reporting on U.S.-backed rebel groups in Syria. Three sources with knowledge of their claim told the Daily Beast. The first known instance of possible reprisals against CENTCOM personnel after analysts accused their bosses of manipulating intelligence reports about the U.S.-led campaign against ISIS in order to paint a rosier picture of progress in the war. Scandal-free administration, by the way, according to the president. Yeah, not a one to find there, anywhere. If only these reporters weren't so soft on the candidates, according to the president. The analyst's skeptical views put them at odds with military brass, the Daily Beast writes, who last year had predicted that a so-called moderate opposition would make up a 15,000-man ground force to take on ISIS in its self-declared caliphate. An initial $500 million program to train and arm those fighters failed spectacularly. Yes, $500 million. We trained a few dozen individuals, all of whom surrendered or were captured. I think one of them might have escaped. And until the very end, the Daily Beast reports, Pentagon leaders claimed the operation was more or less on track. Lawmakers called the plan a joke when General Lloyd Austin, the CENTCOM commander, finally testified last September that there were just four or five American-trained fighters in Syria at the time. And then you remember the president's response was, well, yeah, I thought it was kind of a stupid idea anyway. Why'd you do it? I got to do something, right? That's what lawmakers do. We do something. In the president's case, the bare minimum to get by, to run out the clock, to degrade and ultimately destroy at some point down the road when the president is no longer the president, the capabilities of the Islamic State. The Daily Beast says the working environment at CENTCOM has been described as, quote, toxic and hostile. As the Daily Beast previously reported, more than 50 CENTCOM analysts have said that senior officials gave more scrutiny and pushback to reports that suggested U.S. efforts to destroy ISIS weren't progressing. Analysis that took a more optimistic view of the war effort got comparatively less attention from higher-ups. In a separate development, the head of Iraq analysis at CENTCOM, Gregory Hooker, being reassigned to a position in the United Kingdom. Three sources knowledgeable of the transfer told the Daily Beast he was identified last year by the New York Times as leading the group of analysts that raised objections about the ISIS reports. Now, the Daily Beast says that there is no evidence that Hooker's reassignment was a retaliatory move by his superiors. Rather, some suggested that he had requested the change. Again, if your workplace is toxic and hostile, you're probably wanting to get the hell out of there. At some point, you decide, even if you're a fighter, at some point you decide, it's not worth fighting this. Just get me out. Now, again, this isn't some paper company in Scranton, Pennsylvania. This is U.S. Central Command that we're talking about here. This is life-saving, life-altering work that takes place apparently in an environment that is, quote, toxic and hostile. Apparently in an environment in which the intelligence is being politicized, again, to paint a rosier picture for the administration than what is actually taking place on the ground. This is, again, the type of story that should make some news beyond the Daily Beast. Front page of the Washington Post right now, a lot of talk about the Wisconsin primaries. Donald Trump and the border wall. President Obama, companies that leave U.S. for lower taxes, renounce their citizenship. Iceland's prime minister offers to resign amid the Panama Papers. PayPal scrapping plans for North Carolina facility because of the LGBT law. Yeah. Nothing about ISIS, nothing about CENTCOM. We'll be right back with more after this.
Speaking with Kevin Neuendorf with USA Shooting. Kevin, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm doing wonderful. It's an Olympic year, so a lot of excitement building.
Man, oh, man, there's a lot of excitement. So a lot of things to talk about. We want to talk about Rio, of course. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to that. But first, you have a new campaign that you guys just launched. Tell me about it.
Well, it's the Shooting is My Olympic Sport campaign. So one of the things that we're trying to do is rally a community around the aspect of Olympic shooting. So not many people know that, you know, there's 15 Olympic disciplines, shooting events. And so what we're trying to do is gather everybody around this vast community that we have and really get them to rally around our Olympic shooting sports. So, you know, not many people may follow the Olympics. They, you know, they may know of gymnastics or track and field,
right, yeah.
But we're going to bring them to shooting. You know, we can all rally around that. So that's kind of what we're doing this year.
Awesome.
Going to have a lot of fun around it. So we developed this nice new logo. And just trying to bring everybody together around our cause.
I love it. So tell us about Rio. How's it looking?
Hey, we're looking good. We've got several world champions. Of course, we've got the return of, you know, Kim Rohde, a five-time Olympic medalist.
Great Kim Rohde. What a great ambassador for the shooting sport she is.
Yeah, she's
an ambassadress. I don't know. Whatever the right word. She's awesome.
Yeah, whatever she is, she does it really well, so including shooting. So, you know, so she's got to make her spot still. That's how competitive our events are. Oftentimes, the hardest thing to do in the United States is make our own team.
Right. It's qualify, right?
Qualify.
Yeah.
Because there's that much depth. You know, Kim competes in skeet shooting. Well, we have a world champion in Morgan Kraft who's already earned her spot to Rio. So she beat out Kim.
Uh-oh, here we go.
So there's two spots, and Kim's in the lead right now, and we'll find out in May if she makes the team, but she's looking pretty good right now.
I'll tell you what, Kevin, backstep a little bit with me here, talking about Rio then. What are, because, you know, this is where sometimes it gets confusing even for me, what are the current shooting events that are going to be in the Olympics?
Yeah, if you think it's confusing for you, what do you think I am? So I'm trying to explain it all. We got 15 Olympic events. We got five events in pistol, five events in shotgun, and five events in rifle.
So how does the U.S. Olympic Committee determine that, or how's it? Because didn't one of the events that Kim was in a few years ago got changed or worked in? I know they changed the sports a lot.
Yeah, so the International Olympic Committee really kind of sets the table in terms of what Olympic events are in, and they're always looking at refactoring in a whole bunch of different things, whether it be gender equity or how well they play off on television, or whatever it is. So they're always adding and subtracting events. So it's determined by the International Olympic Committee, and then they work with the International Federation for Shooting.
So now listen to that, folks. 15 shooting events in the Olympics. So shooting is not only my Olympic sport, but the Olympic sport. It's a big part of the Olympics. So it's important we all get to know about it.
Yeah, there's a couple facts there that are important. USA Shooting has won 107 Olympic medals all time. We've been in every Olympics since 1896.
Wow.
A lot of people wouldn't understand the success that we've had, but we're fourth most among all medals. So if you think of the big events, track and field, swimming, gymnastics,
right,
the things that we traditionally dominate in, we're fourth best among all sports in winning
That's
medals.
Awesome.
So we've got a great history of success.
We're there to take that ride with you guys here at NRA News. We love the stuff we do with you. Before we run out of time, Kevin, how can people get more information about USA Shooting, about this new campaign?
We got to go to the website, usashooting.org. You can also find us on social media at USA Shooting. Let's rally around this idea of shooting is my Olympic sport.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nozzler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Tom Mason with the World Forum on Shooting Activities on efforts to fight gun control over in Europe. Also, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum with a nanny state update. Just listening, those of you online, to Kevin Neuendorf of USA Shooting, talking with John Popp during the break. And I saw this right after the show ended Monday, Jenny Thrasher. We talked with Jenny not long ago, member of the West Virginia University NCAA champion rifle team. She herself, an individual NCAA champion at the ripe old age of 18, a college freshman, is Jenny Thrasher. She is also now an Olympian. How about that? Fort Benning, Georgia was the setting. Chris Lawrence of the West Virginia Metro News said Thrasher, fresh off sweeping the individual air rifle and small bore competition at the NCAA Rifle Championships, won the U.S. Olympic trial in Georgia on Monday. The event lasted 3 days, but Thrasher's scores were so high, she literally clinched the victory on day two. Now, again, when you consider the level of competition in the United States for the Olympic team, that is amazing. She ended the overall match, or the match with an overall score, 586 out of a possible 600. She sought 193 standing, 198 prone, 195 kneeling. And when they, when Chris Lawrence of the West Virginia Metro News caught up with her afterwards, said, Jenny Thrasher, you just made the U.S. Olympic team. What are you going to do now? She didn't say she was going to Disney World. She said, right now I'm going to go home and take a calculus test. She said, I'll be shooting a few World Cups this summer, doing some training, then going to Rio, experience it all, and trying to have a great time. I think that is absolutely awesome. She's not done yet, by the way. Next month they have the Olympic Air Rifle Trials. She'll be competing in that as well. So we don't know what the Olympics are going to look like here in Rio. I hope it goes off well for all of the athletes involved. But we are starting to know a little bit more about who those Olympic athletes are going to be, particularly in the shooting sports. In addition to Jenny Thrasher, a freshman at West Virginia University, making the Olympic team, at the men's trials, David Higgins, who is also a college student, earning a spot to compete in Rio. David Higgins is a senior at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He is the first to qualify for the Olympics while a cadet athlete. How about that? After the first day of competition, he was in third place, moved up one spot on day two, closing within 11 points of Matt Emmons. And it was during the final day of competition that David Higgins overtook Matt Emmons. He said it was a great 3 days. I was really training hard for it. Said it was very intimidating shooting against some of the big guys, but I was just relying on all of the training that I've done. I went out and I did my best, and it all came together, and I shot a personal best. In addition to Jenny Thrasher, to David Higgins, Jay Shee also made the team. The Colorado Springs Gazette says other U.S. smallbore shooters who have previously qualified 2012 Olympian Michael McPhail in prone, two-time Olympian Keith Sanderson in rapid-fire pistol. And we'll let you know more names as they are added to the roster of Olympians heading to Rio later in the year. So yesterday on the program, we talked with Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report about George Mason University School of Law changing its name to the Antonin Scalia School of Law there at George Mason University. They're not changing the name, by the way. They're not taking George Mason University off. I've seen so many weird theories about it. It's still going to be George Mason University. It's just their name in the law school after Antonin Scalia. It's not that difficult a concept. Well, in the pages of the Washington Post today, Virginia delegate Marcus Simon, a Democrat from Northern Virginia, really is opposed to renaming the school here. Says they made a mistake, the Board of Visitors at GMU, they made a mistake in agreeing to rename its law school for the late Associate Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And the members of the State Council of Higher Education for Virginia who must approve the name change should exercise their prerogative not to do so. Don't rename the school after Antonin Scalia. Why? He says, what is the cost of accepting this money, this $30 million to rename the school? Even Scalia's greatest admirers, he says, would admit that he was a polarizing figure in the legal community. Unlike some of the truly great jurists who have sat on the court, he was not the author of any groundbreaking opinion that moved our society forward, says Delegate Marcus Simon, who apparently doesn't think much of the Heller decision, since he said so. Delegate Simon says, nor was he known for being able to build consensus on the court in the way that Chief Justice Earl Warren was able to engineer a 9-0 decision in Brown versus Board of Education. Rather, he says, he's best known for his caustic dissents, laced with pointed and often personal attacks on his fellow court members, and for being a champion of the idea of originalism. That is, trying to imagine what the original authors of the Constitution, all of whom were white males and many of whom owned slaves, would think of issues such as affirmative action or same-sex marriage. I gotta tell you, I've never met the delegate. I'm glad he doesn't represent me. He's probably glad he doesn't represent me, too, to be fair. You know, just a quick aside here. That whole point of view about, the Constitution only applied to these white males, many of whom owned slaves, what they would think of these issues. You know, look, first of all, the Constitution was ratified as well as written. Yes, it's true that the franchise was constricted at that point in time as well. But if that's your argument against the Constitution, what's your alternative? Because it kind of sounds to me like you think the whole thing was based on a flawed premise from the start. The Constitution itself, and I wonder if Delegate Simon is aware of this, if he remembers this, in the preamble to the Constitution, we find out why these dead white guys got together, basically locked themselves in a room for 6 weeks, and tried to hash out as many differences as they could. No, society was not perfect. Society wasn't colorblind. There was not equality of the sexes back then. That wasn't why they locked themselves into a room, quite frankly. This new nation that had been built by the men and women who were willing to fight for this country, by the men who were willing to die for this country. This new nation was flailing. It wasn't in a good spot. In fact, it was going to tear itself apart. There was no unity. You had a loose confederation of states. People didn't want to get along. People didn't want to contribute to a shared common defense. You didn't have a real nation. And each and every one of these independent states was going to be ripe for the taking by major European powers that could overwhelm any one of these states individually. Unite or die, as Franklin put it, decades before the framers actually sat down in Philadelphia and started to hash things out. And in the preamble of the Constitution, these men who came again from all around the country, in many ways and in many cases, didn't like each other personally, didn't like each other's philosophies or governing principles. They still sat down and figured out a way to make it work. And they knew that it wasn't perfect. That's the thing. Nobody walked out of that room in Philadelphia patting themselves on the back saying, my God, this is amazing. This is the best thing anybody's ever written in the world. No, they were all a little concerned. They didn't know if this would work. They didn't know how well it was going to go over, how long it would last. But they put down what they tried to do in the preamble of the Constitution. And it was ratified by those who voted. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. So, no, they weren't perfect. But if you don't like what they came up with, or you don't like who they were, and therefore you cannot like what they came up with, at least be honest and say that. Because it seems to me like the criticism of this goes beyond mere criticism of Antonin Scalia and originalism, and really kind of speaks to a critique and a dislike for the foundational documents of this country. Delegate Simon in Northern Virginia goes on to say, modern jurisprudence is moving away from, not towards, his narrow-minded originalist view of the law. He hopes. Supporters of the name change, he argues, will say that regardless of what you think of Scalia's political views and legal opinions, you have to admire his intellect. I would argue that originalism and textualism are anti-intellectual. They reject the concept of context and ridicule those who look for a deeper meaning to understand the ideas that the words written on the page intend to convey. To an originalist and a textualist, Moby Dick, he says, is just a story about a guy hunting a whale. And any further discussion is a waste of time and effort. You know, here's the thing. The Constitution, I mean, you know this already. The Constitution is not literature. You don't study the Constitution in literature class. You don't study the Constitution in 19th century American literature. Where do you study the Constitution? Well, okay, kind of a loaded question. In these days, many classrooms, you probably don't ever. But you should be studying the Constitution in civics class, right? Or in U.S. history class. I would argue you want to talk about Moby Dick and allegory. Great. Great. Have at it. But I don't think that the authors of the Constitution, nor those who ratify the Constitution, were really interested in a lot of hidden subtext. Again, they were writing a foundational rule of law. Here's what the federal government can do. That's what they were writing. Here's what the federal government can do. And here's what they can't do. And again, the reason why we have a Bill of Rights is because there were a number of Americans who said, hey, this Constitution thing, it seems a little open-ended to us in terms of the power that the federal government could assume. We're not really comfortable with passing this document as it is written. Okay, well, would you accept this document with some limiting clauses? Well, what kind of limiting clauses are we talking about here? You know, Congress will pass no law respecting the establishment of religion. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Congress will make no law respecting the housing of quartering troops in private homes. That's, you know, Things like that. Okay, that sounds pretty good. Still a little skeptical here, but all right, we got to do something. Delegate Simon ignores all of this so that he can try to find some sort of hidden meaning in subtext to the laws as they were written. Why the hell would an American people skeptical of the government endorse a document that was full of all kinds of hidden meanings and subtext? That makes no sense whatsoever. They wanted this language to be crystal clear. They wanted it to be plain as day what the government could and could not do. Again, I just read you the preamble from the Constitution. Let's go back to the preamble to the Bill of Rights. Because, again, it makes it pretty clear. Unless, of course, I'm missing the hidden subtext. The conventions of a number of the states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. Again, a number of Americans, when they had the opportunity to ratify the Constitution, said, okay, but only if we get a Bill of Rights. Only if we get some specific guarantees that these are areas of our life that have traditionally been off limits to the Crown, to the Congress, and now to the newly formed federal government, that these areas of our life remain off limits to you. We want these further declaratory and restrictive clauses. They don't restrict us, the people. We're not voting to restrict our own liberties, our own freedoms. No. We are declaring that you, the federal government, are restricted in your actions against us, or we, the people. Why are we doing this? To extend the ground of public confidence in the government. So we feel better about this, quite frankly, because we don't trust you. We'll best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. So if we've got these protections, we think that it's going to work out better for everybody. We have a little bit more trust and faith in the government, and you're able to go off and do the government's appointed duties. Do you see a lot of room for subtext in there? Do you see a lot of room for hidden meanings? You know, he writes to an originalist and a textualist, Moby Dick is just a story about a guy hunting a whale. Well, the Constitution isn't a story. The story of how we got the Constitution is a story. It's a heck of a story. The story of how we got the Bill of Rights is a great story, full of amazing American characters. But the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are not stories. Their laws. The delegate says, of course, all of this is just debatable. Time will tell what the late justice's legacy will actually be. 2 months after his death, it is too early to honor a legacy that is yet to be established. Really, delegate, because you know we've got some Barack Obama elementary schools out there. And he's still in office. Have you objected to that, you think? You think Delegate Simon is, well, it's way too early, way too early. Doubt it. In fact, Delegate Simon says, I would argue that the goal of the $20 million anonymous donor is at least in part to shore up and invent a legacy and begin to write a narrative of Scalia as an intellectual giant. You know, let's go back to what Ruth Bader Ginsburg had to say about George Mason University renaming its law school after Antonin Scalia. As you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg didn't agree with Antonin Scalia legally on most opinions. But she knew him. And what she said was, quote, Justice Scalia was a law teacher, public servant, legal commentator, and jurist Nonpareil. As a colleague who held him in highest esteem and great affection, I miss his bright company and the stimulus he provided, his opinions ever challenging me to meet his best efforts with my own. It is a tribute altogether fitting that George Mason University's law school will bear his name. May the funds for scholarships, faculty growth, and curricular development aid the Antonin Scalia School of Law to achieve the excellence characteristic of Justice Scalia, Grand Master in Life and Law. Yeah, again, Ruth Bader Ginsburg disagreed with Antonin Scalia quite a bit. On the bench, you can find a lot of opinions. But it doesn't stop her from recognizing the honor and the integrity and the intellect of the man. It's too bad that this delegate up there in Northern Virginia can't approach Antonin Scalia in those regards and can't recognize those attributes in the late justice. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. Tom Mason from the World Forum on Shooting Activities will join us later after a quick timeout. Also, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum later in the hour. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums, the National Firearms Museum, what's it all about?
Well, you know, we got three museums now. We used to be the museum. Now we're three museums, and this is the home museum, the NRA National Firearms Museum. This is our 80th year of existence, and we are here at the NRA headquarters building. We've got about 3,000 firearms on display, and we have a number of spectacular new exhibits that have just popped up this past year. Usually it's exciting to get maybe one exhibit every other year, but this year we've got a great steampunk guns exhibit that shows fanciful guns that are artists' creations from steampunk fantasy. And then we compare those to actual guns from the Victorian era that kind of have the same sensibility about them and see if you can tell what's real and what's fake. We've also put in exhibits on America's pistol. And I'm very excited about this one. We have been able to reunite for the first time in a century the two actual pistols that did the head-to-head shootout in 1911 for the U.S. Army to pick their issue sidearm, the Savage Model 1911 45 ACP and the Colt Model 1911, both in 45 ACP, and of course the Colt won that head-to-head challenge. But these were the actual guns that were used in those trials, along with a number of other guns that were experimental models leading up to that.
All right, before we run out of time, how do folks get more information about the NRA National Firearms Museum?
Well, they can come visit us at the NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. If they can't get by, they can come visit us on the website nramuseums.com.
All right, Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums. That's the NRA National Firearms Museum here in Fairfax. Thank you for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, John.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, listen up. You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends, but you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland, where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. That's what it takes. You haven't met the steel workers and the hard rock miners or the swamp folks in Cajun country who can wrestle a full-grown gator out of the water. You haven't met the farmers, the cowboys, the loggers, and the truck drivers. You don't know the mountain men who live off the land or the brave cops who fight the good fight in the urban war zones. No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I emigrated from Venezuela, one of the most dangerous countries in the world today. A few years ago, the government came for our guns. We were told we would be safer without them. Of course, the politicians, the rich and famous, their bodyguards and criminals, they still have their guns. Everyone else lives in fear. Mothers and fathers are powerless to defend their families. But the drug cartels and gangs, the colectivos, still have all the guns they want, and 90% of murders are never solved. The biggest mistake Venezuela's made was believing that this could never happen. Today, they would do anything for the Second Amendment freedom that we enjoy as Americans. Never, ever take it for granted. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Julie Gunlock coming up from the Independent Women's Forum. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy at the top of the hour right now. I want to welcome to the program from the World Forum on Shooting Activities, Mr. Tom Mason joins us. Tom, how are you doing, sir?
Pretty good, Cam. Nice to hear you.
It's good talking with you as well. I appreciate you coming on the story. Saw this story from the European Politico site today. The gun lobby stirs to life in Europe here. Now, it's important to note, Tom, you've been around this issue for a number of years, and you know as well as anybody that there have been groups representing gun owners there within Europe. But what are we seeing here now in the EU? You know, I know a couple of months ago after the attacks in Paris, there were calls for much more restrictive gun control laws than the ones that are already even in place in the EU. Sweeping gun bans were talked about, and we are starting to see maybe some more organized pushback in the EU than we've seen in years past.
That's correct. Cam, this is an interesting phenomenon. We've been working with people in the EU for almost 20 years. Way back in 1996, the NRA helped form the World Forum on Shooting Activities, and that's got about 40 associations. Now we're up to about 50, and we have an incredibly strong representation from Europe. In fact, our official office is in Rome. But anyway, what happened with the EU and after post Paris, this is a real wake up call for our groups in Europe. And I literally got off the phone an hour ago with my European counterpart, Mauro Silvis from Italy, who just returned from Brussels and a meeting at the EU. And he briefed me on what's going on. I want to make a few points here, if I can. I don't want to burn up too much of your time.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's incredibly complex whenever you say you're working with the European Union. You're really working with three groups there. You're working with the Parliament. You're working with what's called the European Commission, which is really a misnomer because it means the European Executive. And then you're working with the European Council, which is all the foreign ministers that get together. They're all working through a thing called the Internal Market Committee. And that's where the action is. That's where Mauro just was. And that's where the decisions will be made. The big controversy right now, and it's very, very complex, but I'm going to try to boil it down. The big controversy is over what they call black rifles. Now, I hate the term. You hate the term.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean anything, but it's basically semi-automatic rifles that even resemble anything military. We don't have a problem here in the United States with that, but they do in Europe. And there really is going to be an attempt to ban in possession of those rifles. There's also going to be a big move to go after museums and collectors that happen to have fully automatic weapons. There's actually no problem, but you know, when you're talking politics, you're talking symbolism. So anyway, it was a wake-up call for the European groups, and among the European groups we're working with is a group called FACE, F-A-C-E. That's the European Hunters Association. They're located in Belgium. They're doing some pretty good work. Nice guy by the name of Filippo Segato, who's kind of a character, but he's been very effective. He's working with the European Union. My friend Mauro is working with the European Union. The European Association of Civil Arms Manufacturers, they separate out military and civilian there. They're also working with the European Union. And a very strong group headquartered in Malta, the European Collectors, is also working with them. But it's a real wake up call, and I'm of real two minds about this. I'm mortified that the Europeans are crazy enough to go after civilian arms like they're going after them. But I'm also gratified that my European brothers and sisters are really kind of waking up on this whole issue, and they're taking as a model. I hate to say this out loud, but they're taking as a model the NRA. They've always looked at us with envy for years and years and years because we've got more political clout than they have. But I think they've learned something from us, and that is that you can't let an argument go unanswered. You can't just trust government. So it's an interesting process. Let me also add that the other side is also picking up on this effort. The article you're referring to talked about a group in Belgium called GRIP. That's an acronym. They've been involved in anti-gun efforts for almost 15 years. So when I saw their name mentioned, I knew this was a serious battle. But, Tim, I've gone on and on, so if you got a question, let me know. I'm probably throwing much too much at you.
No, listen, I appreciate all the information, because this is something that, you know, again, it doesn't get really talked about or covered much, Tom. I remember when I was at, I guess it was SHOT Show 2015, I met a gentleman from France who was over there. This was his first time attending SHOT Show. He was just a gun owner. He was a shooter. We were talking about the politics of gun ownership in France at the time. And he said, you know, look, he said, we don't have anything like the NRA. He said, we can't even talk about the idea of carrying a firearm for self-defense. You'd just be looked at like you were crazy. He said, we've lost so much ground already. So for you to describe this process of trying to, you know, regain some ground or at least stem the tide, you know, it's fascinating, Tom, because it seems to me like, you know, one of the arguments that is the same, whether it's Europe or the United States that you're talking about, here we have lawmakers who have to do something in response to a tragedy, an attack on innocent lives. They say, well, we have to do something. And where they turn is to laws against the law-abiding, right? We have to further restrict what it means to be a law-abiding gun owner. We have to further restrict what it means to be a collector. We have to further restrict what museums can have. You know, that's not where the problem lies right now, Tom, either in Europe or in the United States. There's this chronic Absolutely. Inability to actually deal with the real issues.
That is, you know, Cam, it's the same all over. We get the same thing in the United States. You get the same thing in the European Union. And I can't resist adding that we've got the same thing with the United Nations. Now, not only is the World Forum and the NRA active in the European Union, we're extremely active in the United Nations, and that the exact same battle is fought there. In fact, the same groups tend to fight there also. But then you mentioned self-defense. Let me say something about our conception of government. We as Americans get so used to the idea that the people are sovereign and the people have certain rights. Well, I was just shocked 20 years ago when I got into this business to find out that's not the way it's looked at in the rest of the world. Citizens are not sovereign, and the sovereignty is not felt. I'm being redundant now, but the public's not, the people aren't sovereign in many of these places. The basic European conception is that the state is sovereign and the state will protect you. Well, we rejected that idea in 1776, 1789. With our constitution, our revolution, and our constitution. So in the United States, it's the people that are sovereign, and the people have the ultimate power. The Europeans just love this idea of the state being sovereign. If you want to get really intellectual about it, a German years ago by the name of Max Weber defined that sovereignty as having a monopoly on the right to the use of force. We gave up that idea with the Second Amendment. That's almost theology, and I hate to go into it. That type of detail, but at the heart of many of these matters, these arguments, that's what we're talking about.
Absolutely. Tom, listen, unfortunately, we are almost out of time, but I appreciate you coming on the program, keeping us up to date, and I would love to have you back as developments warrant over there in Europe.
Anytime, Tim, anytime.
All right. Thank you so much, sir. It's always good talking with you. Tom Mason of the World Forum on Shooting Activities. And, yeah, we're paying attention not only to the latest Second Amendment news and information here in the United States, but also on the human right of self-defense all around the globe. When we come back after a quick timeout here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, our friend Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum joins us for a nanny state update. Actually, a look at the rather crummy state of journalism these days. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
I'm here with my good friend Bruce Pyatt, competitive shooter. Bruce, okay, I have to do this interview and introduce you. So what do I say? Okay, here, look at this. Bruce, what haven't you done? NRA 2015 World Shooting Championship winner, five-time Bianchi Cup, NRA Action Pistol. I don't know. How do I introduce Bruce Pyatt?
Well, for 30 years I've been a police officer. I just retired, and the whole time I've been a competitive shooter. I started when I was a kid, and so I guess I'm...
You're Bruce Pyatt.
I guess.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, Bruce Pyatt, what do I need to say? It's been quite a year for you and continues to be. We're going to talk a little bit about what you've done and what you have coming up. And first of all, let's step back. You said you're a police officer, just retired, and thank you for your service as a police officer. How did you get into competitive shooting from being a police officer?
Well, actually, I was a competitive shooter before being a police officer.
Okay, right? So how did that happen?
I started when I was a little kid, just shooting. I was bugging my dad to take me hunting. So what he did is sign me up for NRA small bore 50-foot at a local indoor range.
Good for him, because look what he did. He got you out of his hair, and look what he did for you.
Yeah. Well, I grew up right outside of New York City in New Jersey. There isn't places to shoot, so I had to start indoors. And as soon as the junior program's done, men would come in and shoot bullseye pistol. Well, all the kids would go home, and I'd be standing there at the window watching the men, and I wanted to shoot pistol so bad. You know, let me get in there, and sure enough, some of the men would let me come in and fire a few shots. And
that's cool.
Well, as soon as I could get my hands on a pistol, I was doing it. We had some family heirlooms, you know, from my grandfather. My grandfather had a bunch of guns. He was actually an active shooter. So as soon as I could get my hands on pistols, I was doing it.
And look at Bruce, how natural the mentoring process is. Even these are guys who weren't, or you know, their guys are in there shooting. They saw you had interest. They took you and showed you how to do it. And dude, they lit that fire. That is so great. All right, so the 2015 NRA World Shooting Championship winner, that was an interesting competition. That was something new, right?
It was. This is the second year they had it. It's a very interesting format that they supply all the guns, they supply all the ammo, and it's 12 or 13 different disciplines. We shot everything from cowboy action to precision 22 rimfire, all the way up to long range.
So it really
was power, everything.
And nothing against three gun, Bruce, but unlike three gun, this really was just the gamut of disciplines.
Every discipline, bullseye, handgun, everything. Yeah. And you couldn't be good at one thing and win there. You had to be good at everything. We had aerial shotgun, you know, trap ski, everything.
I'll tell you, and I was talking to some of the competitors out there, and they had to keep the right attitude because there's some competitors who are really, really good at doing certain things. And they came in, and it's like, I can't do this very well. But if you let yourself kind of get caught up in that, it's going to tear you down at a thing like that.
That's exactly true. The guys that were good at IPSC whatever their specialty was, they would push hard at that specialty and thinking that's going to help them along in the whole competition.
Right.
And that really is not the case. You had to be steady and stable the whole way through. You couldn't crash anything.
And stay with it. Speaking of Bruce Pyatt, all right, Bruce. So, okay, moving on, 2016. What you got a lot coming up. Once again, here's the schedule of stuff. And this is just a sampling, ladies and gentlemen, what's coming up for Bruce Pyatt.
There's more.
There's more. What are you looking forward to the most?
Actually, shooting-wise, in November, the World Bianchi Cup match is down in New Zealand.
Oh, nice.
Shooting is shooting. I like shooting anything. But to go down to New Zealand, it's a beautiful place. I've been there twice.
Would you like me to come and cover it for NRA News, Cam and Company?
I got a bag. You can carry my bag.
There you go. Boys, we're going to New Zealand. I always wanted to go to New Zealand.
Take the whole crew.
I'm going to say Bruce Pyatt told me to come to New Zealand. All right. So that kind of stuff like that keeps the fire going, I imagine. Keeps you into it, interested.
Yeah. I've been very fortunate my whole career. You know, police paid my bills, and my sponsors have basically paid for my hobby.
Mention a few of those sponsors.
Caspian Arms, I've been with them my whole shooting career. 29 years I've been with them.
Wow.
Sierra Bullets, Starline Brass, almost the same time. DPMS, Panther Arms.
Cool.
Burris Optics and H&M Black Nitride just came out with them. So
beautiful. All right, before we run out of time, how can we get more information about Bruce Pyatt?
My website, brucepyatt.com.
BrucePyatt.com. Bruce Pyatt, what a guy. You're a great guy, and you're a great mentor. We love what you do, and we love having you here on NRA News.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Top of the hour, Hero of the Day, sponsored by Agcor Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day coming up. Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy, Katie Pavlich of Town Hall. Right now, want to get to our conversation with our friend Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum, who joined us in studio earlier today on a bit of a tear when she showed up. Take a look and a listen. Julie, how are you today? It's good to see you in studio.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. All right, so you went off on a bit of a rant. I love it, by the way, at Acculturated, on selfie journalism. Now, listen, everybody's picking on the media these days. The president's picking on the media. You guys are just too easy on these politicians, he said recently. This is a little bit different. We're not talking about the heavy political news, but even in the realm of the sort of light, gossipy, fluffy news, you're saying the media is falling down on the job, or maybe they're just too self-absorbed. They're too busy with their selfie sticks.
It's unbelievable. I actually said in the piece, look, I know I come off as a curmudgeon, an old person who doesn't understand new social media, but.
And I don't think that's the case, by the way.
Well, thank you. But it really was astonishing. I saw this piece fly past my news feed on Facebook, and it said something about Bobby Flay. So I clicked on it. I like to read about food and write about food. And so I clicked on it. And it was just a really astonishing piece of journalism. This BuzzFeed writer was deployed to a Bobby Flay restaurant to interview him, and there was no interview. It was literally a series of selfies of herself, and there was a scant amount of information about Bobby. In fact, the only time she really mentioned him was when, in one of the selfies, she's kind of holding the camera out and he's behind her. And she mentions, oh, look, he noticed I was taking a selfie. So I kind of mentioned this about how, I mean, some people do get their news entirely from these sources. And when you have such a breakdown of, you know, standards of journalism, it was too fluffy. It was much too fluffy. I'm all for a nice fluffy piece, that, you know, PR hacks can go, yay, we got our boss some good coverage. But this literally had no information about Bobby Flay. And so again, I feel like a lot of these sites, they employ these young kids, and it really is a means of, I don't know, covering themselves. They are the story. The reporters are the story. The actual subject is secondary.
And look, and here's the thing. That phenomenon is not necessarily new. I mean, you go back to Hunter S. Thompson and Gonzo Journalism. One of my favorite reporters out there today is a guy named Charlie LaDuff, who is up in Detroit. And, you know who he is. He has a certain type of story. When I was first starting out in Oklahoma City, there was a reporter named Mike Carpenter, who was a fantastic reporter, but he was always kind of in the story. But here's the thing. You can do that as long as you do it well. And the good reporters who know that their personalities, they know that they may be the hook, right? It's okay for people to watch them because they're entertaining and they're fun, and that's great. But at the end of the day, if they're good reporters, they want to bring people in so that they can tell them a story about somebody else.
Yeah, and I know this happened, but I encourage people, find my piece. Then I put a link into her piece. It'll boggle your mind that this actually got published. It really is. I don't know if you looked at the original piece. It's really nothing but selfies. And then at one point, she's also kind of a mean girl. She's sort of a mean girl. She takes a picture of a woman who's giving her a dirty look. And that was the only picture that wasn't her, was a picture of a woman sitting at an adjacent table who was probably annoyed. This was me. This is why I love this woman. She's an every woman. She's the sort of 40-something-year-old woman who's annoyed by this, you know, hipster, sort of young, millennial kind of attitude. So, I'm not trying to just pick on these reporters who sometimes become a part of the story. Again, I think I agree with you. It happens.
Well, no, and I didn't I didn't think that you were. I was just, you know, look, it can be done well.
Yeah.
It wasn't
this was
done
not well.
Well. And it's more than just this one story here. You're right. I think that there is a new generation. I hate to just say, oh, it's all millennials. But there is
still,
a new generation of journalists out there. These darn millennials are always congregating.
Get off my lawn. Get off my lawn. I actually sent this to my editor and I said, I think this I sound like a get off my lawn, like old man, but maybe I'm just ready for it. I'm just ready to embrace that phase.
I don't think that you are. I think that this is a very logical response to a media that is failing to do, again, even the fluffy stuff right.
Yeah.
They're not even getting the fluffy stuff. This should be the easy stuff, as you say. They're not even getting this right. You know, somewhere along the line, I think that a lot of broadcast journalists decided that they wanted to be Jon Stewart.
Right.
And being snarky was more fun than being serious all the time. It's also easier to be snarky than it is to be an investigative journalist and a real watchdog.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got the Jon Stewart phenomenon happening in broadcast media. I think that, you know, the rise of the blogger a decade ago has, for better or for worse, in probably both ways, changed online media. And so it is very much about not just building the brand of, you know, BuzzFeed, but every reporter is out there trying to build their own brand as well. And I don't know where are the editors, Julie? I mean, where is the person at BuzzFeed who said, hey, Kalen, you know, I kind of thought this was supposed to be about Bobby Flay. Where was that editorial judgment? You know, when I was first starting out as a reporter, my news director was a guy named Jerry Bonin. And he was a grizzled veteran of the newsroom, and he taught me a lot, and he was scary. And you didn't want to go to Jerry with bad stuff because he would look at you with his eyeglasses and read it, and then look up at you and it'd say, this is crap. And, you know, and you knew that it was.
Well, at the very least.
Where is that person at BuzzFeed?
But also, I mean, I'm not even asking for good reporting. I'm asking
for CNN
I'm asking for content, okay? I'm talking about that. Like, there's nothing in this article, literally nothing in this article except the reporter's face. So I'm actually I'm requiring, I feel like a pretty basic thing in a piece you've written, which is content. And so it doesn't even contain that. And you know, I think you're right. There's just the editorial standards have really gone down and I get it, you know, so our culture has changed. So of these things, but we start to see it. We can laugh about this piece and look, it's about a chef. It's about a celebrity chef. Who cares? But I think the trend actually becomes a real problem because we see it in other areas, the refusal of reporters to really look deep into scientific issues. And we see them, you know, there'll be a press release from an environmental group that says, this study says, and then that, it is astonishing to me. You can just Google the science or the activist organization and realize that that's not a good study. They don't even do that. On the gun debate, you know, you have reporters just repeating what they hear. They know nothing about guns. They know nothing about gun culture. They know nothing about, you know, why people want guns. Mm-hmm. And so they just promote this narrative. They're just told what to say. So, you know, this Buzz piece post that I wrote, you know, my head wanted to explode when I read it. But I think there's a more serious problem and there's more serious questions about journalism. And this is just, you know, one example.
And we talk about this on the show all of the time. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this, because, yeah, as you say, this isn't serious journalism. It's not expected to be serious journalism, but it's still bad. It's not journalism where there's no content there. And so, again, if they're getting the fluffy stuff wrong, you know, look at what gets left out of our news coverage every night, Julie.
Yeah.
All of the stories that you know, don't get covered because we're covering the sideshow, we're covering the circus. And, you know, there was a report last week, hundreds of military dependents ordered to leave Turkey because of the deteriorating security situation there.
Yeah.
You know, that was not front page news. That was not, a block of the nightly news. That was just sort of a minor little story.
The only stories involving guns on the nightly news or in the newspapers or in the mainstream media involves, you know, some horrific crime. You never You never hear stories in the mainstream media about women defending themselves, people defending themselves against, rapists and murderers and you know, people who come in to rob them. I mean, you never hear these stories, and thank God for alternative media and NRA News and other things that does tell that story.
Yeah, but I'll give you a perfect example of this. So about a week and a half ago now in Indianapolis, Indiana, there was a mom at home with her infant child.
Yep.
Guy breaks in. He's got a gun. He shoots at her. She's got a gun. She shoots back. He was found with a walkie-talkie and zip ties. Now, this was in Indianapolis. You know who lives in Indianapolis, Julie, or around the Indianapolis area? Shannon Watts, the head of Moms Demand Action. Here you have a mom in Indianapolis defending herself and her child. Do you think any of the news stations sought a quote from Shannon Watts?
Right, no. No.
If they did, they didn't get one. And if they didn't, they didn't say.
They didn't say they tried.
We asked Shannon Watts for a comment.
Right.
And nothing. You know, now to me, that's a no-brainer. If I were a news director for any one of those TV stations, I would have been livid about that.
Yeah.
How do you ignore an expert in the field, so to speak, when the story's in your backyard? But it's these basic steps of not, there's no institutional knowledge. There's no desire. What I see and what really I think bothers me, Julie, is that, to me, that sort of great, ineffable quality of a reporter is you have to be curious.
Yes.
You have to have questions.
Yes.
You have to always have questions.
Yes.
And I don't see that.
No.
I see preen.
There is a narrative.
A desire. Yeah, and a narrative.
They are not reporters. They are repeaters. I've said this for years. They are repeaters. They repeat what is on their talking point sheet, whatever activist organization has put out a press release. I actually did this once. I found an article in a local newspaper, and I compared it to the EWG, Environmental Working Group. I had the Environmental Working Group press release, and I compared it. It was plagiarism, first of all. It was. I wrote about this. It was almost word for word. I mean, some editor had tinkered with like three or four words, but it was a word for word copy of the EWG press release, which was filled with lies, obviously. So I, of course, write a blog post on that saying, well, actually it's not true. And this reporter really didn't do his job. I mean, that reporter should have been fired. I mean, that's plagiarism. So they don't even try to cover it up. They don't even try to hide it. They don't even try to just take a few concepts from the press release and put it. They will literally copy it. So there's a real problem in journalism. BuzzFeed's fluff pieces is a small part of it. It was very therapeutic to write this. But I think it's a problem that goes much bigger, and it goes much more beyond BuzzFeed and sort of this one run reporter.
Well, listen, Julie, I appreciate you writing this. It was good to vent. And you're always welcome to write a piece like this before you come on the show, and we can vent together. Thank you so much. Have a great week.
Thanks for having me.
Julie Gunlock with the Independent Women's Forum. And don't forget, now at NRAnews.com, you can check out, I should have mentioned this earlier, Julie, your trip to the NRA range with the women from the Independent Women's Forum. It's up now and available for all to see.
We have to talk about that next week. It was amazing.
It really, really was. All right. So next week we'll talk about it, and we'll maybe even play a little clip between now and then. All right. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. All right. Coming up next hour, Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy in the Chicagoland area. He's going to be speaking at the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day on Wednesday. We'll talk about the violence in Chicago. Another violent weekend, 33 people wounded, one person killed between Friday afternoon and early Monday. Katie Pavlich of Town Hall joining us on the program next hour as well. She's got a piece at The Hill. Says Obama has proven that he is not serious about guns. I might, again, actually disagree a little bit with Katie there. I think that President Obama is absolutely serious about guns. I think that he is unserious about violent crime. Now, we do have some legislative news to tell you about. In Mississippi, permitless carry legislation has passed out of the legislature. The House has given final approval to House Bill 786. The vote was 85-35, and they have sent the bill on to Mississippi Governor Phil Bryan for his expected signature. What this does is this expands the current permitless carry options to include belt and shoulder holsters. It allows church authorities to develop security programs that designate enhanced carry permit holders or those with military or law enforcement backgrounds to protect places of worship and receive the benefits of existing protections under the state's Castle Doctrine law. It also prohibits state or local enforcement of federal executive orders or agency regulations not approved by Congress, which conflict with the Constitution of the United States or the Mississippi Constitution. When Governor Bryant signs the legislation, as he is expected to do so, Mississippi will become the ninth state to adopt permitless carry legislation. Now, again, Mississippi is not getting rid of its concealed carry license, but if this bill becomes law, Mississippi residents would not need that license to legally carry there in the state. So if you are a Mississippi gun owner, make sure that you've contacted your House member, your state senator. Thank them for their vote, if, in fact, they voted in favor of the bill. Also, make sure you contact Governor Phil Bryant as well. We are still watching what's going on in Georgia. Headlines every day talking about the waiting game. What will Governor Deal do there in Georgia with not just the campus carry legislation, but that's House Bill 859. There's also another piece of legislation that is on the governor's desk, House Bill 1060, which is an omnibus carry bill. It establishes some additional reciprocity agreements for people who move to the state of Georgia. You can actually carry on your old license for 90 days after you move to the state. Prohibits a probate judge from suspending or extending, delaying, or avoiding the process of issuing that Georgia weapons license application. Also protects any firearms instructor who lawfully instructs, educates, or trains a person in the safe, proper, or technical use of a firearm from civil liability for any injuries caused by the failure of such person to use such firearm properly or lawfully. So, again, you've got to House Bill 859, House Bill 1060 on Governor Nathan Deal's desk in Georgia. Make sure, because, again, the gun control advocates, they are spending money. They're trying to get folks to contact the governor's office, urging him to oppose these measures and to veto these measures. So make sure that if you are a gun owner in Georgia or you know someone who is, that they have made and you have made your opinion known politely, of course, to Governor Deal there in Georgia as well. Stick around. Hour three of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler, returns right after this quick timeout. We've been talking about Virginia State Trooper Chad Durmeyer. Talked about the chief of Newport News, Virginia, where Chad Durmeyer served as a police officer. But, you know, and I thought about actually using our good guys segment today to talk about Trooper Chad Durmeyer. But I don't think we need to do that. I think we could just take a couple of minutes here. In fact, maybe we should take a couple of minutes here to talk about the good guy that was Chad Durmeyer. He, as I mentioned, served in Newport News till 2007. Returned to Virginia, graduated from the Virginia State Police Academy in November of 2014. The Daily Press newspaper says that Brian Bowyer, who's a resident of Newport News, had a brief interaction with Chad Durmeyer, but it stuck with him. Bowyer's daughter was involved in an accident on the interstate in August of 2015. Bowyer is a former Newport News police officer, talked about the fact that Durmeyer was the investigating officer, and he talked about how Chad Durmeyer had a calming effect on those involved in the wreck. Bowyer said he had everything under control. It was obvious that his calling was to be a police officer. Said he was definitely a person that was happy, confident, and professional. Somebody that you'd be proud to have as a friend and as a coworker. Another news story from the Richmond area, Channel 13, WVEC. They had aired a story back in January of this year that featured Officer Chad Durmeyer. The story was talking about in Hampton Roads on a Friday morning, a guy driving to work, a guy named Dave Floyd, saw these two state troopers who were running down the road going after a little dog. Dave Floyd said they were like talking to the microphone back and forth, trying to catch the little dog. The troopers involved in the pooch pursuit, Channel 13 says, Chad Dermeyer and Jeremy Hagwood. First spotted the dog on Interstate 64 in Hampton at LaSalle Avenue. Tailed the little dog by car and then on foot to I-664 at Aberdeen Road. Chad Dermeyer said at the time he was a little guy and he was off to the races. 4 miles they chased the little dog. Trooper Hagwood said he didn't want to stop for us. He kept going around in circles, going the wrong direction on the interstate, running between cars. Some drivers stopped to help. Troopers eventually cornered the dog, scooped him up alongside the road. They were able to ID the dog. Thanks to tags, they returned him to his owner, Jeffrey Corbin, who said, quote, I want to say thank you. Thank you very much, so much. Pinta is a member of the family. He's a great companion to us. Story went viral locally there. Got thousands of likes on Facebook at the time. Chad Dermeyer told the Channel 13, makes me feel good. This is the type of stuff that makes up our good guy stories every day. And it sounds like that's who Chad Dermeyer was. One of the many, many good guys out there. Killed in the line of duty by a guy who, according to his own family, kind of took pride in being a bad guy. Wanted to be infamous. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, starts right now. Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy on the program this hour. Katie Pavlich of Town Hall join us as well. We've got the hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day, all coming up here in the next couple of minutes as well. We were talking right before the break about some of the latest legislative news, permitless carry in Mississippi, going to Governor Phil Bryant's desk. Meanwhile, in Georgia, Governor Nathan Deal still has on his desk two pieces of pro-gun legislation. In Washington State, it's not often you see a headline in Washington State like this, pro-gun bill signed into law by governor. How about that? It was last Friday, Washington Governor Jay Inslee signing Senate Bill 6165 into law. This was the companion bill to House Bill 2481. It clarifies the current exemption in Washington law that is intended to allow individuals who are licensed under federal law to manufacture, own, buy, sell, furnish, or be in possession of short-barreled rifles. This was not apparently adequately expressed there in the written exemption. Now it is, and so this is good news for those NRA members and SBR owners there in Washington State. All right, let's get to our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCore Defense. We're going to talk with Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy there in the Chicagoland area a little bit later on in the hour, but we've got a story from Chicago, the Chicago Sun-Times, and again, a story that would not have been able to have been written a couple of years ago, because a couple of years ago, people in Chicago couldn't legally carry a firearm for self-defense. The powers that be in Illinois reluctantly accepted that the right to carry was coming one way or the other. Remember, we had a court case out of the Seventh Circuit that said Illinois cannot ban the carrying of firearms. Right now, and at the time, I should say, Illinois did not have a law allowing the carrying of firearms. Open carry was banned. Concealed carry was banned. You couldn't legally carry a firearm. The Seventh Circuit said, this is wrong. You can't do that. Clearly, if you have the right to bear arms in your home, you have the right to bear arms on the street where you are more likely to be the victim of a violent crime than in your 35th story apartment. So, rather than appeal this decision up to the U.S. Supreme Court, the powers that be there in Illinois said, fine, let's fine, we'll accept a concealed carry law. And they tried to make it as onerous as they could, but we ultimately still ended up with a shall issue law. Not perfect, but a great start when before, again, residents in Illinois had no ability to carry a firearm for self-defense legally. And so the Chicago Sun-Times reports that a man who was shot and killed while trying to rob two others in the Uptown neighborhood last Thursday night has been identified. Two 23-year-old men were unloading a vehicle in an alley. It was on West Winona. It was about 10:30 in the evening. A 28-year-old man walked up and demanded their things, according to the Chicago police. Chicago Sun-Times reports that one of the younger men handed over his cell phone and wallet. But when the robber said that he was taking the car as well, the other 23-year-old pulled out a gun and shot him multiple times. 28-year-old William C. George, taken to Advocate Illinois Masonic Medical Center, where he was pronounced dead at 2:59 a.m. Police say that the victim who defended himself and his friend, licensed to have the weapon, not charged. Police say that the suspect in this case, 28-year-old William George, had been on parole for a past armed robbery conviction. The Chicago Sun-Times doesn't say what kind of sentence William George received for that past armed robbery conviction, nor do they say if that was the only armed robbery conviction in Mr. George's history. But the 23-year-old concealed carry holder there in Chicago who defended himself and his friend, today's hero of the day. I might add another argument against the idea that, these concealed carry holders who are college students are too irresponsible, they're too drunk, they're too whatever to carry a firearm. Here's a 23-year-old who was able to act in self-defense. But again, I'm sure this is another 23-year-old that the anti-gun activists won't acknowledge. Our deal of the day today from Hartford, Connecticut, the Hartford Current, reporting a New Britain man with a long criminal history involving guns and drugs pleaded guilty on Monday to violating the terms of his probation from a 2005 conviction for shooting a 12-year-old boy on Kent Street. 32-year-old Abram Hanna, convicted after a trial of first-degree assault and carrying a pistol without a permit for the shooting of Martin McClendon on July 9, 2003. Hanna, sentenced by then-Hartford Superior Court Judge Michael Sheldon to 10 years in prison and 5 years of probation. He was released to probation on January 2, 2015, and on December 12th of 2015, less than a year later, Hanna was caught with a handgun. Charged with criminal possession of a firearm and violating the terms of his probation, he was a passenger in a vehicle and fled when police pulled it over. Police chased Hanna, noted that he was, quote, clinching his waistband. He ran into an apartment building and into a bathroom. Prosecutor told the Superior Court judge there that a gun was found stashed in the toilet tank. On Monday, the Hartford Current says Hanna admitted violated probation and pleaded guilty to the gun charge, and as part of a plea deal negotiated by his defense attorney, Gerald Klein, as well as the prosecutor, David Zagaya, agreed to a 3.5-year prison sentence and 6.5 years of special parole. Now, this guy, again, federal court, will be eligible for 10 years behind bars. He's not going to get it. He's not going to get anywhere close to that. Remember, the sentence is 3.5 years. He's not going to do 3.5 years. The prosecutor told the judge that the agreement was a compromise made necessary because of issues with the search for the gun. And the prosecutor told the judge the system will have 10 years to watch this defendant. Well, that's great and all. But, you know, when this guy got out of prison in January of 2015, he was supposed to be on probation for 5 years. So you could say, well, you know what? The state is going to have 5 years to watch this defendant. But he was still caught with a gun less than a year later. And he wasn't caught with a gun because the system was keeping an eye on him. He was caught with a gun because he was in a car that was pulled over by police. He was a passenger in the car that was pulled over by police, and then he took off running. So the probation system didn't keep an eye on Abram Hanna. And as soon as he got out of prison, or at least within months after he got out of prison, after serving time for shooting a 12-year-old boy, he's back up to his bad behavior. The defense attorney told the judge that Hanna had been employed since his release from prison and had not violated his probation in any other way. The judge, however, said that Abram Hanna's criminal record, quote, does not inspire confidence. And then he listed Hanna's convictions for a variety of crimes. See, this 12-year sentence for shooting a 12-year-old boy, not the only time that Abram Hanna's been in trouble with the law. The judge, according to the Hartford Courant, also praised the defense attorney for his work. Quote, Mr. Klein, you've worked wonders to get a sentence this low. That's what the judge told the defense attorney. You've worked wonders to get a sentence this low. Now, look, every attorney is there to represent their client the best way that they can. Prosecutor is there to represent the state the best way they can. The defense attorney is there to represent their client the best way they can. But I hate seeing a judge tell a defense attorney, man, you got a great deal for your client. Particularly when that client is a man who has spent much of the last decade behind bars, much of his adult life perhaps has spent in some form or fashion under the supervision of the criminal justice system. And yet again, walking away with a sweetheart deal. So, congratulations to Abram Hanna. Your attorney did great work. Even the judge was impressed. But you are still today's deal of the day. Our hero of the day also comes from the Hartford Courant. Just sort of serendipitous how it worked out that way. I guess if you live in Connecticut, you can be bothered by the deal of the day, but you can at least be a little relieved that you have law enforcement officers like Jill Kydick out there on the streets. It was December 13th, just after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Call came in to 911, a one-year-old boy, unresponsive and not breathing. Officer Jill Kydick, who's 32, she's been a Hartford police officer for almost a decade, was the first one to arrive on the scene. She said any officer that hears that call and is available when there's a child involved especially goes. Everybody goes. But she got there first. Family comes running towards her. They're carrying the child. The boy's mom was frantic. Boy's uncle said to Jill Kydick, you have medical training, you have to save this child. Jill Kydick said, immediately you check the child from head to toe, you try to figure out what's going on. She said it was hard to figure out what had happened because the mother couldn't speak. She was so upset. And she said she had to rely on the medical training that she had received in the police academy as well as a recent refresher course that she had taken. She said, you know you have the training, but now this is real. So she tried to look into the boy's mouth to see if there was something blocking his airway. His jaws clenched on tight. She said, you're afraid to do what you would do to an adult. Talking about chest compressions for CPR. She said, you want to make sure that you don't hurt the child more. She's still by herself at this point. No other help has arrived. It's just her and this one-year-old child who's not breathing. She says, I'm trying CPR. I'm trying to open his mouth to see if anything is blocking his throat. She tried the Heimlich maneuver, since one of the adults said that the boy had been eating cereal before he stopped breathing. Nothing. Keeps rotating. CPR, nothing. Heimlich, nothing. And then, something. The Hartford Courant says whatever he was choking on dislodged, and Jill Kydick says this blood-curdling scream came out of him. That baby crying was the best sound in the world. because you can't cry if you can't get your breath. And so when you hear a baby cry, you know that that baby can get oxygen into their lungs. Firefighters soon arrived, an ambulance followed. Firefighters told Jill Kydick, good job. She says, this is what I signed up to do. She said, this is stuff that doesn't happen that often. When it does, it's definitely life-changing. And she also said this was a team effort. She said, you know, somebody had to give me the training to know how to do what I did. I just happened to be the first one there. In the right place, at the right time, able to do the right thing. And willing, but able to do the right thing. So she had just had this refresher course on first aid. Sergeant Jeffrey Morrison there in Hartford, Connecticut, had taught that to her. She ran into him. And she says he told her, I'm so proud of you. And she said, I'm just so glad that you were my teacher. So Jill Kydick, recently honored by the Hartford Police Department with its life-saving award. The one-year-old was taken to the hospital, spent a few days there recovering, but he has recovered. And Jill Kydick says she has a new appreciation for the sound of babies screaming. She says, I don't care if they're screaming. That tells me they're healthy. Well, Officer Jill Kydick of the Hartford Police Department, we thank you for being one of the many, many good guys out there. When we come back here on this edition of NRA News Cam and Company, we're going to talk about a story that unfortunately I think is going to be a continuing story throughout the year here, the violence in the city of Chicago. It is spiking right now in the city. You have, I think it's fair to say, disarray within the upper echelons of the police department and city hall. There is so much political wrangling going on. As I mentioned, Rahm Emanuel rejecting all of the police board candidates. In essence, a bit of a power grab here, trying to remove the authority of the police board to present these nominees. He wants to just go it alone, wants the Chicago City Council to change the laws there that they operate under so that the mayor has more power and more authority. And in the meantime, the good people in the bad neighborhoods in Chicago, they just want this to stop. And for decades now, they have heard politician after politician, elected leader after elected leader, community official after community official tell them, we just need a little more money. We just need a little more power. We just need a few more gun laws. We just need this, that, or the other thing. And you know what? The violence never goes away. It might decline along with the rest of the country, but it's always still higher than the rest of the country. And right now, while most of the United States still enjoying crime at 40-year lows, in Chicago, the homicide rate is spiking. And there is no sign of it being of it abating anytime soon. As a matter of fact, you start getting into the warmer months, and there is a real concern. This is when the violence typically picks up. Well, it has already picked up in Chicago. So we're going to talk about what's going on and what can be done. For real, what can be done. Not, hey, we have to do something. Let's try to pass another gun control law. Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy, going to be speaking at the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day in Springfield on Wednesday. He joins us on NRA News Cam and Company right after this quick timeout.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called blended learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills are just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day, in half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there are 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself, Bill Pohl. Thank you so much, sir.
Here's the truth about the Hollywood celebrities, political elites, and billionaires who attack the Second Amendment. The thought of average people owning firearms makes them uncomfortable. They don't like how the men and women who build their office buildings, vacation homes, and luxury cars, who mop their floors, clean their clothes, and serve their dinner, have access to the same level of protection as their armed security guards. They want you to surrender your freedom for a false promise of government-provided security they will never rely upon themselves. But no amount of money, power, or fame gives anyone the right to take our freedom away. At the core of the Second Amendment is the eternal truth that no life is more worthy of armed protection than another. That's what I believe, and that's what I fight for. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I know the truth about Benghazi. I was there, fighting alongside five Americans who were all raised to believe that if you have a chance to save someone's life and you don't try, that's more criminal than anything else. So we fought for 13 hours and we saved lives. But we are not unique. We are no different than the Americans who ran back into those crumbling New York towers, or the Americans who tackled the armed terrorists on that French train, or the many faceless, nameless Americans who every day risk their lives for perfect strangers trapped in burning cars or dangerous waters. Because if they didn't, no one would. Where was that courage among the politicians who had the power to make a difference during those 13 hours in Benghazi? I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Katie Pavlich of Town Hall join us in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome to the program. You have seen him in the Freedom Safest Place spot during our breaks and on television from Top Shot Academy there in the Chicagoland area. Chip Eberhardt is with us. Chip, how you doing, sir?
Hey, Cam. I'm well. How are you?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. I want to ask you first about the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day on Wednesday. There in Springfield, you're going to be speaking tomorrow, right?
I will. Yeah, I'll be speaking there about noon tomorrow in Springfield. It's our 10th year. Masad Ayoub's going to be there alongside me. I am completely excited about this. Very honored to be speaking, and I hope we can get people, you know, really motivated to continue in participating in the, you know, the political process, because, you know, politics is like a game of football. Either you play the game or you are the football. And I think a lot of people around the country are tired of getting kicked around, so they got to suit up and get in the game and make a play.
Absolutely. And, you know, look, I mean, you know as well as anybody, Chip, how far the state of Illinois has come over the past 10 years as the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day has been taking place. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, the idea that that Illinois would have a concealed carry law, this was something that there were folks who were, you know, desperately fighting for, but it looked like there was no movement, no will, and certainly no desire among anti-gun politicians in Chicago to take that step. Yet here we are in 2016, and you've got a, I think, a very popular and successful concealed carry law, and there are many Chicagoans who are actually taking advantage of the law, taking advantage of their rights, and they are legally and lawfully carrying a firearm for their defense.
They are, and you know, and it is working. You know, it's a tough road, you know, and you know, I got to say, you know, without the NRA, I don't know if it would have been possible. It's a tough road getting there, and but we're here now. It's not perfect, but you know, if we pull together, we can make it better, and it is working. And you know, there's so much gun violence in Chicago. Really, there's so much violence, mm-hmm. but none of it is by law-abiding citizens. None of it.
No, you know, as a matter of fact, we had a story earlier this hour, a couple of 23-year-olds who were unloading a car in an alley. It was last Thursday night. 28-year-old guy on parole for armed robbery shows up, has a gun, says, I want your stuff. They cooperate at first, and then he says, I'm taking your car, too. That's when one of the individuals who was a concealed carry holder pulled out his firearm, shot in defense of himself and his friend. He's not facing any charges. The would-be armed robber was shot and killed. You know, we are seeing stories like that on occasion, Chip, but what we are not seeing are stories of concealed carry holders engaging in drive-by shootings or the wanton gang violence that plagues some neighborhoods in Chicago.
Yeah. Outgoing, you know, superintendent of police, Gary McCarthy, I remember he, along with mayor of Chicago, you know, Rahm Emanuel, they predicted if we have concealed carry in Chicago, there'll be blood running in the streets. You know, there's already blood running in the streets, but it's not because of concealed carry. Just like that story illustrated, concealed carry is saving innocent lives. It's saving innocent lives. There's no, you know, we've had this law almost 3 years, and there's still no blood running in the streets. It's not the Wild West. You know, it's hard to believe that this was the last state in the country to pass a concealed carry law. And as you said, I didn't think it would happen in my lifetime. But now that it has happened, you know, I'm very proud to be a part of that.
You know, at the same time, Chip, violent crime is skyrocketing in Chicago this year. We know that anti-gun politicians love to blame violent crime on law-abiding citizens. So it wouldn't surprise me if we see people call for more gun control laws to address the violent crime in Chicago. But, you know, when you look at what's going on in these communities and in these neighborhoods, as a former law enforcement officer yourself, why would another round of gun control laws not be the answer?
The reason that more gun control won't be the answer is just like, you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir, because criminals don't obey the laws. And because the problem is not, it's not the guns. The problem is the crime. The problem is, I mean, it's twofold. There's a fracturing of the gangs, so they're breaking up, so there's going to be more violence there. There's really poor, really poor, you know, police presence, and the police are not motivated. The morale is down because of the, you know, the way that they're being profiled. I mean, look at the morale in Chicago. Rahm Emanuel just placed this guy, Eddie Johnson, in the role as a temporary superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
He's the third guy he's put in there in 4 months. You know, it's like people don't know who the leadership is even, so how can they have good morale? And then the other thing is, you know, on the state level, the prosecutors, they are inundated with these criminals, and they're not taking control. They're not prosecuting them. They're making all of these plea deals because their caseload's so big. They don't have the manpower to properly deal with these criminals and put them behind bars. If they would actually do their jobs as prosecutors, we wouldn't see these repeat criminals out here doing the same thing over and over again.
Talking again with Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy, I want to hone in on a couple of things that you talked about, Chip. You talked about the morale of the police department. And Rahm Emanuel putting in place Eddie Johnson rejecting all three of the candidates that were offered by the police board. And now the Chicago Press reporting that Rahm Emanuel basically wants the Chicago City Council to change the law so that the police board doesn't make those recommendations and the mayor can pick whoever he wants. You know, to call the mayor embattled at this point, I think, is an understatement. You've got protests against Rahm Emanuel for so many different things. Rahm Emanuel is kind of hunkered down behind closed doors. He's not doing a lot of public appearances. I guess he is content to let this crisis go to waste, perhaps. Or maybe not. Maybe he is viewing this crisis as a chance to gain more power for the position of mayor. But, you know, honestly, I mean, if you're one of those good people in one of these bad neighborhoods, Chip, do you really care at this point if Rahm Emanuel has more power? You want results. You want to see, again, a functioning police force that can actually do its job in these dangerous neighborhoods.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's funny is, you know, what's one of the big quotes about Rahm is never let any opportunity go to a waste.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so maybe that is what he's trying to do, but whatever he's trying to do, it's not effective. And as you said, the bottom line is we want to see effective policing. We want to see effective crime control, and we're not seeing it. You know, I can't believe that any sober person would vote for, you know, him for another term. I it's hard for me to believe that he's still there. I mean, he's proven himself, you know, just not worthy of the position. And, you know, public opinion for him is so low. It's just unimaginable.
You know, Chip, I'm curious because you're obviously getting a lot of residents of Chicago there looking for instruction. And I'm sure that you've had folks, students who, you know, are some of those good people in the bad neighborhoods. Do you have a lot of people who come to your class? Do you have anybody who comes for instruction who says, listen, I'm getting my concealed carry license, but don't get me wrong, Chip, I still want all kinds of additional gun control laws out there. You know, this is just sort of a stopgap measure, whatever. What I'd really like to see is for, you know, a semi-auto ban. Let's have those universal background checks. Is that attitude on display, or are people done with politicians saying, you know what, it's going to be the next round of gun control laws that work?
Yeah, like I said, Cam, we get sober people in our class. That's ridiculous. No, we haven't gotten anybody like that. And, you know, I mean, no, nobody wants, none of the law-abiding citizens want more gun control. What they want is more policing. They want more policing, and they want policing and prosecution. You know, just like we talked about last time, you know, over 4,000 people walk into gun stores in Illinois and, you know, try to purchase guns. How many were prosecuted under the federal laws that would put them away? About 80. You know, that's mm-hmm. crazy. That's absolutely insane. They want the existing laws to be taken seriously. They want the existing laws to be policed, the existing laws to be prosecuted.
Well, you know, you look at a guy responsible for the death of a Virginia State Trooper here last week. Lengthy criminal history from up in Aurora, Illinois. At one point had a charge of attempted murder and felon in possession of a firearm. They dropped the attempted murder charge. They prosecute him on the gun charge. They end up giving him a reduced sentence on the gun charge, Chip. And so, you know, what started out with attempted murder ends up with, I think, 25 months he served before he was released early. And here's a guy who, again, was already well-known to law enforcement. He was already one of those guys who's responsible for a disproportionate amount of violent crime. And that still happens. I mean, that, you know, when you talk about the system, this is the system right now. This is the norm. That's not the exception.
No, it's because like I said, the prosecutors are overworked, underpaid. Most of them, you know, most of the prosecutors, they're just using the prosecutor's office as a stepping stone. That's the reality. And they need a high conviction rate. And you know what? When they get a plea deal, that goes into conviction rate. So they'd rather, mm-hmm. rather than risk a loss in trial, they'd rather plead it down and sell out the citizens. And that's what they're doing, putting these violent criminals back on the streets because they're too lazy to do their jobs.
So I got to ask you, Chip, are you confident – are you hopeful that that Chicago's going to turn a corner this year? I mean, you know, we're getting into the time of year where typically the violence starts to increase. The weather gets warmer, more people are outside. But we've already started 2016 in a bad way in Chicago. Do you think it's going to get worse as the year goes on?
The numbers are already, like you said, the numbers are already high. My fear is it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse before it gets better. Just like you said, as the weather gets better, we're going to see more criminals out. We're going to see more crime. We're going to see them hanging out more. And it's going to be bad. I hope I'm wrong. I hope and pray that I'm wrong. But I see this is going to be a record year for Chicago based on the way things are going, based on the trends, based on the lack of morale, based on the lack of leadership. It's not going to be a good year.
Talking again with Chip Eberhardt of Top Shot Academy, and I've got to ask Chip, what are you seeing in terms of interest for concealed carry license? Are you getting a lot of people from the Chicago area? Are you seeing those good people in bad neighborhoods? Are they coming to get trained with you?
Some of the good people of Chicago are starting to come in, but it's strange. In Chicago, which Chicago really doesn't represent Illinois.
Right.
We have a saying, you know, just outside Chicago, there's a beautiful place called Illinois. You know, Chicago may be the, you know, political controlling party, but really, it's not the whole overview. And that is, Illinois has and will always be a firearm owner's gun state. But Chicago, because of what happened in 83 with Jane Byrne banning handguns, Chicago guns are really new. They're very taboo. Even myself, growing up in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, I was taught that only criminals and police have guns. Good people actually don't have guns. That's what I was taught. And, you know, still we need to wake up a lot of people and let them understand that you have a responsibility to yourself and to your family to be the first responder. You have a responsibility to have the ability to defend yourself. You know, to be without it, I'm sorry, to live in Chicago and be a law-abiding citizen and not have a firearm, that's like not having a fire extinguisher.
Absolutely. Chip, listen, unfortunately, we've got to take a break, but I really do appreciate you coming on the program. I hope that there is fantastic turnout tomorrow for the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day in Springfield, and I would love to have you back on the program in the future, sir.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it, and thanks for having me on today.
Absolutely. We'll talk again soon. Chip Eberhardt joined us of a Top Shot Academy. When we come back here on the program, Katie Pavlich of Town Hall joins us. She's got a piece at The Hill. Says Obama is proving that he is not serious about guns here because his rhetoric is not matching up with his actual policy steps that he's taking. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
It's not difficult for readers or viewers to make that leap from a distrust of men to an inherent distrust of guns. And that's exactly what, you know, Everytown, Shannon Watts, and newfound besties at Cosmo want you to understand and take away from that.
Yeah, this is, I think what really concerns me is because this isn't an honest debate and it's not an honest conversation.
No.
This is a branding campaign.
Oh, my gosh, absolutely.
And, you know, what they are trying to brand is guns are not for women.
No, and I think that they're so used to pandering to a specific type of brand. You know, mm-hmm. God forbid some of us women who want to take quizzes and see what scandal character we are and that we do morning yoga and we go to brunch with our girlfriends afterwards, God forbid we own firearms somehow. And we're now supposedly less than because we've educated ourselves and want to choose to take our self-protection seriously. Why is that so bad?
Well, I don't think it's bad at all. And, you know, it's interesting, Kimberly, because I think it may have been the same day that this video was released by Cosmo. There was the story, I know that you saw this out of Indianapolis, a young mom at home with her infant. Guy breaks in. Mm-hmm. She has a gun. She uses that gun in defense of herself and her child. The guy is found to have on his person zip ties and a walkie-talkie, which kind of tells me this guy was in communication with somebody else and this guy wasn't necessarily interested in the stuff that was inside that home. He was interested in the people who were inside that home.
So often, more often than not anyway, sex assault is about power and control. It's not about sex as so many people want you to believe, especially when it's being touted by a political campaign. You know, I have honestly been told, well, you survived without a gun. What's the big deal? You know,
wow.
You use different methods to get away, and they don't use a gun. And statistically, that could have been turned around on you anyway. The biggest problem here is that those comments start. They start with victim blaming. It's on me somehow to think of ways to get away without turning to, like, literally the greatest equalizer of our time. Statistically, men are bigger than women. What's the best way to physically equalize myself against an attacker? A firearm. I'm not going to take my chances with a rape whistle or, you know, I actually tried saying that, hey, I made up a lie, said I have an STD, I have to go to the bathroom, I'm claustrophobic. I tried all of these things. They did not thwart that attack. But, I mean, furthermore, what no one cares to hear is that while I might have been my attacker's first victim that we could at least identify, at the time of his arrest, it was just 3 weeks later, he was picked up at an apartment complex not half a mile from mine. He was taking pictures of other college women that were sunbathing around the pool. He's choosing his next victim. So, yes, I survived. But at what point does this man's growing number of victims and escalating behavior stop? This guy had zip ties in his back pocket and all of these things. But, you know, we're not going to hear more than one or two media cycles because it doesn't fit the mainstream media narrative.
Right.
But he had to start somewhere. And I'm guessing he started at the same point as my rapist did. It's breaking in. It's stealing underwear. It's seeing how far you can get. How far can you push until you just start escalating and escalating? And, yes, this woman did a fantastic job of protecting herself and her kids, and that story is not going to get the attention that it so deserves. But the Cosmo articles definitely will.
That's the thing. I don't even know if this story out of Indianapolis, I don't think it got national attention. I think I saw it in one other, like, local TV station that wasn't in the Indianapolis area had picked up the story. But you're right. And, you know, the Cosmo story is going to get that attention. Here's the thing, though. You know, I think, as you say, I don't think Cosmo is serving its audience because I'm guessing, Kimberly, that there are some Cosmo readers out there who are also gun owners.
Or at least there were.
Okay.
Well,
point,
you know,
point taken.
So this is going to sound terrible. I was scrolling through their Twitter feed looking for that original post about the gun control conversation.
Yeah.
Let me give you a little brief taste of what these guys also peddle to their readers. Are you ready for this? What it's like to fall in love with your brother. Real headline. Are you sexually attracted to the wax version of Justin Bieber? And why drink normal beer when you can drink vagina beer? Excuse me, that is in no way, shape, or form the people that I want telling me about how best to protect myself. I literally feel my face melting from the stupidity.
Suffering from a lack of credibility is what you're saying.
I think that's exactly what this
is. Yeah. Thank you again for joining us here on another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Still to come on the program, we'll give you a sneak peek at tomorrow's show. But right now, want to welcome to the program Katie Pavlich from Town Hall. How you doing, Katie?
Good. How are you?
I am fantastic. All right. So you've got a piece at The Hill talking about Obama's recent commutations, right? 61 sentences commuted, and the president says he's going to do everything he can to get tough on people who use guns illegally. Cut them a break, actually, in many cases last week.
Yeah. So as your listeners know, President Obama started out the year with his executive actions on gun control, and he gave us all a big lecture from the White House about how 30,000 Americans are victims of gun violence or suicide and how we have to stop this violence and we have to do something about it and that we can absolutely curb gun violence. I only use that term because they use it. So, you know, don't think that I'm condoning the term. But the president says that we can, you know, get that under control while we respect the Second Amendment. Well, you know, fast forward a couple months and last week, President Obama, like many presidents before him, commuted a series of sentences for people who broke federal drug laws. So the White House portrayed this as, you know, we're allowing these 61 people who have committed drug crimes to restart their lives. we are over criminalizing drug offenses in this country, blah, blah, blah. So they sold it as a harmless issue of drugs, which many would argue isn't harmless, but that's beside the point, right? Mm-hmm. But if you look deeper into the sentences that were commuted, and this is all on the White House website, you'll find that 12 of the sentences that President Obama commuted included people who were not just convicted of things like running a crack house in a local neighborhood, distributing crack cocaine, but also having a firearm in their possession as an already convicted felon, which is illegal. And by the way, using those firearms to carry out their violent drug crimes. And so it's a little hard to take when the president lectures the country about gun control and what they call gun violence, when just last week we saw the president give 12 people who violated federal gun laws in a serious violent manner to carry out other crimes a get-out-of-prison-free card. And, of course, as you know, and many of your listeners know, this comes on top of years of the Obama Justice Department under Holder and under Loretta Lynch during her short tenure of not prosecuting federal violations of federal gun laws that we already have on the books.
Yep, absolutely.
So when you look at the actions against what he's been telling us, he actually really isn't that interested in reducing violence and keeping criminals who violate federal gun laws in prison until they're done serving their sentences.
No, you're exactly right. Now, you know, I do think that Barack Obama is serious about guns in the hands of law-abiding gun owners, right? I mean, I think that he's serious about reducing the number of guns in this country. He's talked about that.
In the hands of law-abiding people.
Exactly, yeah, right. But in terms of, you know, public safety, you know, again, because he's more interested and because all of these policies are directed at the law-abiding, They're not public safety measures. They're not anti-crime measures. They are anti-gun measures. When you look at, and I'm glad that you talked about the record of Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch, you know, federal weapons prosecutions have declined under this administration. For a long time, Chicago was the worst jurisdiction among all of the mm-hmm. federal districts for weapons prosecution. We had the murderer of this Virginia State trooper with a rap mm-hmm. sheet as long as his arm in Illinois. And I don't think any of his crimes were ever referred to federal court for prosecution. And, you know, here we've got, you know, a guy who's stuck in the revolving door of justice getting attempted murder charges and a felon in possession charges get pled down to gun possession charges. He does like 2.5 years behind bars for attempted murder. You know, you want to get serious in violent crime, you have to get serious about the violent criminals.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the left oftentimes tries to separate crime from individuals. They act like criminals, you know, maybe we're just raised the wrong way or whatever, and they make excuses for them. But there's really no excuse in, you know, misleading the public, as the White House did, by saying these were harmless drug trafficking crimes. When you look at the list of things that these people were convicted of, I mean, here's just one example. Kavanaugh Gavin of 8 Mile, Alabama, was serving federal time for using and carrying a firearm in furtherance of his possession of crack cocaine and intent to distribute. Here's another guy who was convicted of running a crack house in a neighborhood, which we know violates the rights of the people living around them, right? That's not good for them.
Mm-hmm.
But then he was using guns to carry out those crimes and to make sure that his drug trafficking streams were delivered on time so he could get his money. I mean, it's crazy that they're trying to act like commuting these sentences, which are coupled with these violent drug trafficking crimes, have nothing to do with keeping violent criminals who use guns illegally behind bars. It's like they don't get that equation. When you keep criminals who violate federal gun laws behind bars, they can't then go out and continue to commit those crimes. And we see it over and over and over again while we continue to get lectured about how we need to reduce gun violence, right? I mean, it's an absurd circle of nonsense.
You know, and what's sad, Katie, is that we've seen this or at least seen similar efforts here in California a couple of years ago. Remember they had, I think it was Prop 14, because they had to do something about the prison population, and they weren't going to build any new prisons. So they had this referendum, and they told the voters of California, listen, you're only going to be letting nonviolent offenders out a little bit early, right? That nothing to worry about. And what we have seen is that it doesn't matter. You could have had 19 violent offenses, but if your 20th offense that you are currently in prison for was a nonviolent offense, you were considered a nonviolent offender, and you were eligible for early release. And, you know, you talk with law enforcement officers across California, and they'll tell you they are seeing the effects of Prop 14. They are seeing this revolving door of justice speed up a little bit faster. And, by the way, we're also seeing violent crime increase in Los Angeles.
Oh, shocker, right?
Yeah, right?
You let the criminals out on the street when there's no consequences for their actions, when the law is not enforced or watered down, you see more crime. I mean, it really is amazing how we hear this argument for criminal justice reform, and there are valid arguments for it. However, when you're simply not when your response to criminal justice reform is that you need to have less of an enforcement of the laws we already have to prevent true violent criminals who couple their crimes with what they would acknowledge as nonviolent, you're going to create problems on the streets of America. And guess who suffers because of that? Not the criminals. They don't care. This is a lifestyle for them, right? It's the people who want their neighborhoods to be safe. It's the people that come visit here, you know, who should, you know, I think Greg Gutfeld once said, you know, all these Europeans who judge the United States for putting people behind bars when they violate our laws should really, you know, then not, you know, come here and visit our safe streets, because that's why they're as safe as they are now. And as we're seeing, when you don't enforce those laws and allow criminals to come out and not looking at their entire record, which they know what the record is, then of course you're going to see an increase in crime.
Talking again with Katie Pavlich from Town Hall. And unfortunately, I think that you're right. I mean, we've just been talking about what's going on in Chicago, particularly where violent crime is spiking and, you know, investigative stops are down. Prosecutions are down. You've got a mayor who's, I think, more interested in the optics and in, you know, clinging bitterly to his job than in actually fixing anything. Cameron just sent me a story here. This is from the Las Vegas Sun. Today, as a matter of fact, Sheriff links Las Vegas crime hike to California law to reduce prison crowding. So, you know, it's the damnedest thing, Katie. It's almost like actions have consequences. Right?
It's amazing, right? You let violent people out onto the streets without consequences for their actions, and guess what they're going to do? They're going to continue their lifestyle of violence. It really is incredible.
Just crazy talk. Just crazy talk from you, Katie. Well, listen, I do appreciate you coming on the program. It is always a pleasure talking with you. I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but will we see you in Louisville this year?
I will be there. I think I'm actually speaking on Friday, so we'll see you guys there.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you. Thanks for coming on the program.
Absolutely.
And, we'll talk again soon.
Talk to you. Bye.
Katie Pavlich joining us from Town Hall here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Metro Police Sheriff Joseph Lombardo in Las Vegas. Depopulation in California jails and gang members moving to the Las Vegas Valley might be contributing to the rise in violent crime. He said that there's a plethora of reasons why the valley might be experiencing a hike. But he said the Las Vegas metro area has had an increase of interactions with California gang members during arrests and investigations. He said that influx is directly related to, I believe, the depopulation of the prison system in California. I said this was Prop 14. It was actually Prop 47. California ballot initiative turned into law in November of 2014. The Las Vegas Sun says the proposition allows for some felony drug possession sentences to be reduced to misdemeanors, thus reducing many inmate sentences. The proposition also makes cases involving petty theft, receiving stolen property, or writing bad checks to be sentenced as misdemeanors. Inmates with violent criminal backgrounds are not eligible for reductions, the Las Vegas Sun says. Well, they might not be eligible, but they're certainly taking advantage of it, so I don't know how that's working. But there have been any number of stories pointing out individuals with violent histories who have been released early under Prop 47. And keep in mind, there's also a spillover effect. So you've got people who are released early. You've got another population of people who would have been sentenced to prison who instead are serving out their sentence in county jails where they're also going to be eligible for early release. That in turn means that there are fewer beds available for people who are arrested, charged with a crime. Maybe they want to set a high bond because they think the individual is a flight risk or a danger to the community. And more of those people are being put out on the streets while they are awaiting trial because there's not room for them. But heaven forbid you actually, you know, I don't know, build a prison. Clearly that's not the answer, at least not the way that the state of California is going. The Las Vegas Sun says from January 1st through Saturday, Metro Police Department investigated 37 homicides, which is a 68% increase compared to the same time last year. Investigations involving sexual assault, robberies, and assault with a deadly weapon are also up about 20% in Las Vegas. So a couple of weeks ago, they started what's called a violent crime initiative, tasking its plainclothes detectives to suit up and patrol the streets on two-week deployment cycles. They say that has maybe made a difference. Violent crime is down since they started doing this, but the chief there says he's not quite ready to credit this program. But he does see the response from police personnel is very positive. He says they've seen the benefit of it. They've seen an effect on crime associated with it. Other methods of combating crime include the hiring of more officers. The chief there says that Metro would need to hire 325 to 350 additional officers to reach the ideal ratio of two officers per 1,000 permanent residents. Said anything else or anything less than that, and it becomes difficult for us to be proactive versus reactive. So, you know, again, we're hearing, and a lot of this goes back to the recession in 2008, when law enforcement agencies around the country had to lay off a lot of staff. And I remember reporting at the time, you had sheriff's offices that were saying, we're not going to be able to provide 24-hour coverage anymore. And a lot of them have not been able to go back to that spot where they could provide 24-hour coverage. That's in, you know, rural areas. But even in big cities, forces haven't quite been decimated. We're not talking about, you know, 10% losses, but they are down hundreds of officers from where they should be. And it doesn't look, again, like there is a budgetary priority to get those numbers back up. All right, we've only got about 60 seconds left here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Want to let you know what's coming up tomorrow on the program. Congressman Mike Kelly from Pennsylvania is going to join us on the program. Bob Owens of Bearing Arms will be with us on the program as well. Liz Lazarus will join us as well. She's got a very, very interesting story talking about Free of Malice. We'll talk with Liz Lazarus about that on tomorrow's program. Also, another armed citizen story for you and the hero of the day. Unfortunately, I know we're going to have a deal of the day for you as well. But a good guy for you coming up tomorrow and all of the day's latest Second Amendment news and information. It's all coming up right here on the next edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.